Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
The Babel fish, said the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy quietly, is small, yellow, and leech-like, and probably the oddest thing in the universe. It feeds on brainwave energy received not from its own carrier, but from those around it. It absorbs all unconscious mental frequencies from this brainwave energy to nourish itself with. It then excretes into the mind of its carrier a telepathic matrix formed by combining the conscious thought frequencies with nerve signals picked up from the speech centers of the brain which has supplied them. The practical upshot of all this is that if you stick a Babel fish in your ear, you can instantly understand anything that is said to you in any form of language. The speech patterns you actually hear decode the brainwave matrix which has been fed into your mind by your Babel fish. Now, it is such a bizarrely improbable coincidence that anything so mind-bogglingly useful could have evolved purely by chance that some thinkers have chosen to see it as a final and clinching proof of the non-existence of God. The argument goes something like this. I refuse to prove that I exist, says God, for proof denies faith, and without faith I am nothing. But, says man, the Babel fish is a dead giveaway, isn't it? It could not have evolved by chance. It proves you exist, and so therefore by your own arguments you don't. QED. Oh dear, says God, I hadn't thought of that, and promptly vanishes in a puff of logic. Oh, that was easy, says man, and for an encore goes on to prove that black is white and gets himself killed on the next zebra crossing. Most leading theologians claim that this argument is a load of dingo's kidneys, but that didn't stop Ulan Khalufid making a small fortune when he used it as the central theme of his best-selling book, Well, That About Wraps It Up for God. Meanwhile, the poor Babel fish, by effectively removing all barriers to communication between different races and cultures, has caused more and bloodier wars than anything else in the history of creation.
Minutes after the hour of one, and this is the month of January in the year of our Lord 2011. Thank you for drawing near, that ye might be entertained and amused by these, the voyages of the Starship Emerson. We are coming to you live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district here in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon, the home of all good things. Thank you for joining us. It is Friday, and welcome to day 12. By the way, just looking around the table here, I see that we've got one Hams open, two Vizos open. Dawn has already dropped some Pop-Tarts down the front of her shirt, although she thinks I didn't notice that. And I saw you packing up a bunch of empty cans into a plastic bag like some sort of a homeless person.
Just one can. I was actually trying to straighten up a bit because I realized we have a guest in the studio today. Uh-huh. And so I just had too much trash over here. I had the plastic
I'll
bag.
I'll put this single can in the trash. The whole joint is classic.
Well, I also had an empty paper plastic bag from my convenience store run, so I thought I would combine the two into one thing and, like, stash it under the table. Because I had one of those Starbucks double shots with the energy drink crap in it things. So.
Okay.
Because I needed to be super, super caffeinated for today.
This is what it's like to live with Jennifer Lopez. Just nothing but glamour all day long. It is the Rick Emerson Cavalcade of Whimsy. Thank you for joining us. If you would like to be part of the program telephonically speaking with your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, ruminations, ponderings, amusements of an ironic nature, whatever it is you have to bring to the figurative or literal table, it's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. That is rick at RickEmerson.com if you'd like to engage with us via a series of zeros and ones and tubes and tunnels. You can also email Dawn Taylor if you'd like. It's Dawn, D-A-W-N, Dawn at RickEmerson.com. Let's see. Text box open via the website. That is at RickEmerson.com. And our Skype username is RickEmerson Show. That is RickEmerson Show. So there you go. Or you could just think really, really hard. Perhaps, perhaps train a small gnome of some kind to ferry your message here and to balance my bodily humors while he's at it. It's 503-505-6964. Coming up today, it is Friday, so we have Big Jim Willie coming in the studio today. He's going to be doing another installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101. Today, talking about the life, work, and career of Mr. Drew Carey. So that's Big Jim Willie going to be in the studio later on. We'll also be talking to our good friend Eric D. Snyder, who is at the Sundance Film Festival. It's going to be coming at like 2-something, 2:15, 2 o'clock?
A little after 2 was what he said.
So about 45 minutes from now, we will be talking to Mr. Eric D. Snyder of EricDSnyder.com. He also writes for Film.com, Cinematical, and he can be heard on the movie show, Movie BS, rather, with Bear and Snyder, Fridays 11 to noon at Cascadia.fm. So we'll be talking to him later on. And then the festival itself wraps up. Is it Sunday? Is that when they do the? Is that when the grand jury
something
does
like
the,
that,
the whatever and they announce
it's
all the awards
coming up
and everything?
Soon.
All right, so we'll be talking to him about 45 minutes from now. Also, penis watch coming up today, taser watch coming up today,
and a snuff watch.
And a snuff watch, really? Has it just happened? Has someone just died within the last few moments?
Well, it just came to my attention in the last half hour.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Let's, by the way, try to ignore the fact that I sounded strangely happy and excited about the death of a fellow human being. It's not really
dead
that
person,
as such.
Huzzah!
Here's the thing about it is that, I realized at some point that I had to. It's just that it's the next chapter in the ongoing saga, the ongoing book of man. And so whenever there is a piece of news that happens, one realizes that one is witnessing history as it unfolds. It's not that I'm happy about the death of somebody else. Sometimes I am, but not always.
Or it could just be somebody becoming worm food.
That's the thing. If it's somebody who just. As they used to say, assumes room temperature. You know, hey, sometimes that's a tragedy. Sometimes it's just some dick we didn't need. I don't even know who today who today's snuff watch is. Is it a is it somebody who is well known to me?
They themselves are not well known to you, but the thing that they created is.
Is it the guy that invented Pringles?
No.
You're sure about that?
Yes.
Did he invent a food of any kind?
Not that I'm aware of.
Is it somebody who... Okay, I'll do one more. Is it somebody... I'll do one more, and if I'm correct about this, I'll keep guessing. But if not, then I will abandon this until we get to the actual snuff watch itself. Did he create, perfect, or bring to the mainstream an electronic device?
No.
Okay, well, never mind. So forth. It's 503-505-6964, so that's all coming up today. Big Jim Willig, penis watch, taser watch, snuff watch. Also, Eric D. Snyder calling us from Sundance, and we'll do clue number 5 in the EH Vending contest for Snack of the Week. So EH Vending's Snack of the Week contest. The Name That Snack contest for this week, we will do clue number 5. Now, here's why you care about that, because we've given out clues 1 through 4 the last 4 days of this week. Once we give out today's clue, if you have a guess, if you can correctly identify the snack via snack at rickemerson.com. If you were the first person via email to correctly identify the snack at snack at rickemerson.com, you'll win a hefty heaping helping of caloric fun from the fine folks at EH Vending. So if you were the first person to correctly identify this week's snack at snack at rickemerson.com, once we've given out clue number 5, which comes up later on today. In addition to all of this, Don Taylor is tracking the following headlines for you on this Friday.
The Ford Motor Company is making a whole lot of money. The Chinese government blocks a hilarious and very violent satirical cartoon. And a Facts of Life actress comes out of the closet.
I think I know who it is.
Okay.
I don't know if I want to. Should I guess now?
If you
or should
want
I wait?
To.
Okay, here's the thing about the Facts of Life actresses and the coming out of the closet. There's who it probably is. There's who it probably is. There's who I want it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's who it could conceivably be, but probably isn't. Okay, I'm gonna wait.
You can save your guess till later.
Yeah, that's the thing. No, this is the thing where it's like we've already got so much stuff to do, and we're gonna get terribly behind if I start going down the road of you know, if I start going down the road of lesbianic experiences at Easton, then there's just, we're never, and Langley after that, by the way, they ran a candy store with, what's his name, Sean Astin's younger brother, then, you know, we're just never going to get back on track. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program, so that's all coming up today. Penis Watch, Taser Watch, Big Jim Willig in the studio. Clue number 5 for the EH Vending Name That Snack Contest, Eric D. Snyder, and apparently a Facts of Life actress reveals her gayness. So that is all on the way.
It's huge. It's a huge show.
Really is legally too much show, Don. More show than really one could think would be mathematically or scientifically possible in terms of conveyance. Let's see. I had something else to say, but it's all gone by the wayside. So I will simply say that I held here. Now it's gone. Where the hell? Where did I put my Pop-Tarts? All right, hold on a second. So I have to say that after yesterday's discussion of Pop-Tarts, which took up, I would say we spent like a good 11 or 12 minutes talking about just rhapsodizing about Pop-Tarts for no readily apparent reason yesterday. We both settled on the brown sugar and cinnamon, frosted brown sugar and cinnamon, as the definitive flavor, the best flavor that there is. Because there is a Pop-Tarts setting on the toaster in the kitchen here. So if you were to go into the kitchen, the break room, and you were looking, it says, where it says you're adjusting the toaster to be like either lighter or darker, and halfway between the two settings, there is a Pop-Tarts. There's some sort of a line of demarcation, which apparently is the ideal setting for Pop-Tarts. So we had this whole discussion, and I didn't think that this was actually true, but you can in fact get, because you...
Yeah, I told you.
You paid 79 cents for these. Mm-hmm. Where did you get these? Well, this is like...
At the 7-day market up on at 20th and Division.
So it wasn't like a Plaid Pantry, but I mean, it wasn't like you got these at the day-old food store, can store or something.
You can now get these pretty much at all convenience stores and 7-Elevens, the little individual packages with two Pop-Tarts in the packet.
Do you ever look at a thing of Pop-Tarts and it's like 79 cents, which means that they're, whatever, they're 39 cents each? And you think that really... Just imperialism isn't so bad, really. You know, whatever it is that we do that's horrible on the rest of the world, whatever faults or failings or sins we commit as a nation, it really, in the grand scheme of things, is worth it. If for 39 cents I can obtain something as wonderful and delectable as a Pop-Tart, then really, it's all a wash and a net gain, really, for me.
And if you go to this particular convenience store, they have, like 8 different flavors. So you can have your chocolate Pop-Tarts, your s'mores-flavored Pop-Tarts, your cherry, your strawberry, your brown sugar cinnamon, whatever you were actually in the mood for, 79 cents, boom, Pop-Tart.
I got to say 3 different things. One, when I lived in San Diego, there was a place not too far from there, and it was sort of like a dollar store. I mean, I guess it was a dollar store, but it was like a super dollar store because it was one of those places where restaurants and hotel chains, and I think occasionally just companies, would dump lots of stuff that they couldn't sell. Or if they created some product and then realized that it wasn't, like, really wasn't going to be able to move the way that they thought it would, or that it had too much of it. And so then they would just go to the dollar store, and I think that they would just sell it to them in bulk, and they then would pass it along to, like, me. And so occasionally you would go, and you would see, it would be like some weird kind of breakfast cereal. You know, it would be like, what's this? Well, it's Joe Pesci breakfast cereal, you know, or it would be like Bill and Ted's like excellent oat flakes or something. That, like, something that nobody would really want. It would be some horrible variation on Captain Crunch, you know, that just seemed like repellent in every way, but the company hadn't really thought that far ahead, and so they would make thousands and thousands of boxes of it, and then they would realize that it was just not moving, so they would sell it all to this store, and then they would pass it along for like a dollar a box. And you would go in once in a great while, and this was the sort of slot machine payoff that was sporadic but tempting enough that it would keep me coming back. They would have Pop-Tarts, and they came in these, and I think they must have been from like a hotel or something, because they were Pop-Tarts, and they had the big logo, but they were big black and white boxes, and they did not have any sort of decoration. It just said Kellogg's Pop-Tarts, but then it would be some bizarre flavor. It would be like peanut butter and jelly Pop-Tarts, or just something, you know, something like really strange. And so for like a dollar, you could get a box of 12 of them. I mean, it didn't even seem possible. And plus, they were flavors that you would really never see anywhere else, which is a wholly different experience from like the day-old bread places and sort of like government cheese facilities that I would go to as a child where the food was horrible.
That's what grocery outlet is for. You go to these grocery outlet stores and they're like a dollar store of food. And you find these things like these bizarre off brands of vegetables you've never heard of. And yeah, the giant industrial things of strange Pop-Tart flavors and like soda flavors you've never seen, like 2-liter bottles of like Shasta tiki lime punch or something really insane. And it's like a quarter. Because it was a failed experiment in flavor that no one wanted. And so they just ship it to another state. And then here in Oregon, like, we can buy it for like 30 cents if we want to. I love grocery outlets.
Let me ask you this. When you're, if you're like at a Safeway or just a, you know, like a regular, supermarket, and you're back by, like this, the Safeway by my house, there's a whole back section, and it's between these two sections. It's between the dairy aisle and then this bizarre thing that they've done with the vitamin section, where I don't know what it is with the vitamin, where it's like they've taken just like what used to be your daily multivitamin, and they've now made each component of it like its own bottle of crap that you have to buy.
Oh, yeah.
I had to look for like 12 minutes to find just the one a day, like the thing that they give you when you're a kid that's just like the little red tablet or whatever.
That
just
Trader Joe's. Get your vitamins at Trader Joe's.
Yeah, but it was buried like way deep in this thicket of like other bottles and boxes and whatever. But right between the two is that strange, It's a sort of multi-shelved metal rack.
Yeah, the rack of day-old bread.
Where they
bread
put
products.
Old stuff.
Yeah.
Now, do you do this? Do you actually like look around to make sure that nobody's going to observe you going to the day-old bread thing, because then they're going to think that you're just some welfare case?
No, I have no shame about that stuff anymore. I don't care. I go, "Ooh, look, cheap food."
See,
I don't care. It's like I also love the Entenmann's / Oro Wheat like cheap bread store. Have you ever done that?
No.
Oh my God! Yes.
Sorry.
Yeah, they take when the stuff has gotten a little bit too old, or they've made too much of it, or it's been pulled from the shelves at the supermarket. It goes to the Oro Wheat / Entenmann's store, and then they sell it really cheap. And the worst, and then they want to unload it as much as possible.
Is this like one of those temporary toy stores that opens in Lloyd Center just to sell things to grubby children?
No, except that it's always there. You look online, there's several locations. I go to the one in the Lake Oswego, so I don't have to have any kind of shame because, hell, it's Lake Oswego. But yeah, the bread is all cheaper, and they've got like the Entenmann's and all of that stuff and bubbly shells and all the stuff that they sell. And then it's like, if you buy like, you know, $6 worth of stuff, you get like something off the free shelf, so you get another load of bread. Then if you go, and then they have all these weird
things.
Is there
a guy like next to there asking you to like guess the weight and win an eraser?
No, it's really freaky because the more stuff you buy, the more free crap they throw at you. And then there's also these special days like Tuesdays, all the bread's 50 cents. On Wednesdays, you get like a free box of cake. And the more stuff you buy, well, for every $5, you get like another thing off the free thing. So if you go there and you spend $30, you walk out with like enough bread and pastries to last you for a month.
It sounds like some sort of bread store meets Japanese game show.
It is a little bit.
There's a guy named like Uncle Nutsy, you know.
And then there's a punch card. So for every like dollar you spend or something, they punch off the punch card. So there, I've been in there seriously when it's like I just go in to buy three things and it's like, well, you know, if you buy one more thing, then you get like a loaf of bread or some cheese Danish. Like, okay, so I buy one more thing and I get the thing. It's like, well, let me punch your card. Oh, well, you got now your card's full, so you get another thing. And you know, it's 4-for-1 Wednesday. If you want to buy tortillas, and it's crazy.
If you buy another bag of bagels, you get to reach into Uncle Bonko's fun sack. So, all right.
But no one wants that.
But no one wants the fun sack from Uncle Bonko. All right.
So I tell you, the Entenmann's Oro Wheat store is a load of entertainment fun.
And see, if it's an entire store of those products, then everybody feels shame. Therefore, no one feels shame.
And they also have weird off brands of like Mexican cookies and things that cost almost nothing. And so you buy them and then you open them in the car and you eat them and you go, oh, my God, these are horrible. And then, but it was like a dime.
Is it
so
like
it's
every?
Okay.
Is it like all of that stuff where it's like it's you know, it's like a combination, like it's like a combination peanut butter and like chili lime powder.
Yeah, it's like peanut butter and like, except that instead of being a cookie, it's like the same stuff they make those really cheap ice cream cones out of, and then it's got a picture of like a burro holding some balloons on the front or something.
It's an ice cream cone with newsprint on the side of it.
Yeah.
And, okay. I guess.
And then you're just going, I have no idea why I thought this would be a good idea.
And you just know that somewhere in a factory there's somebody snickering at you.
But on the other hand, free cheese day.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio program. I have no idea why I was even telling that story. Oh, it's because I went to Safeway last night. Because we were having this entire conversation about Pop-Tarts, which then became a conversation about that Quaker Oat granola cereal, which, by the way, as you know, it's not really like granola or health food in any way.
No.
And there's sort of, you know, the beaming, smug Quaker guy himself on the front, sort of, you know, you're being taken advantage of, you know, with a huge beaming grin.
And they try to convince you that it's healthy because it's all full of oats and honey.
It just, it's
and it's really just fat and sugar and deliciousness.
Glued together with more sugar and honey and, you know, and then brown sugar and then glazed with some sugar and then rolled in a delightful topping of sugar and then just put into a box. And that is one of those things that, like, that I just can't, that I can't let myself eat very often. And I actually went so far last night as to stop at Safeway on the way home, and I got all the way into the cereal aisle, which is just sort of, and the cereal aisle is just this, like, sort of this, just this, like, this Dante's Inferno of caloric temptation for me anyway, because it's all I can do. I mean, if left to my own devices, I mean, my diet would consist entirely of things that come out of a box and either have a cheese packet or a like a janky toy surprise at the bottom, you know. And that cereal is really, it is just one of my, it is one of my Achilles heels. It's a chink in my food based armor. But I actually got it. I made it all the way into the store last night, and I was actually standing in the cereal aisle, and I went so far as to just reach for the cereal, and then I just had to fight down the impulse to buy it, and I had to just navigate my way back out, because I realized that if I got home, the thing about that cereal is that it's not, it's like they started doing that thing a few years ago where they would sell you the like the pre-portioned items, where it's like you would buy a bag of cookies or something, but inside the box of cookies there would be like 12 separate bags in 100, because then the thing about that is, and I know that theoretically you could eat the entire box of 12 bags, but at least it adds an extra hurdle of embarrassment for yourself.
Those are for skinny girls who, like, are worried about, like, every 100 calories, though.
I don't think so.
That's just to feed that psychotic skinny girl thing.
I don't think so. Here's the reason why I think those are effective. Because it forces you to acknowledge, not just once, but over and over and over again, that you have no self-control when it comes to eating things like that. So I would just, the first time Laura brought home a box of these, and I opened them up, and I said, well, what is this? It's all like in a bunch of little bags. And she didn't, I guess she wasn't. She goes, oh, I guess it's one of those calorie control things. And I said, what does that mean? And she goes, well, instead of a box of 6 million calories worth of cookies, it's like 60 little bags of 100 calories each. And I said, okay. And I then realized that if I got up and I did my thing of sort of like shame binging at like 2:30 in the morning when everybody in the house is asleep, that I then had to open every bag individually, and you had to just sort of go through this gauntlet of personal shame over, you had to admit to yourself like 17 times in a row in the space of about 4 minutes that you were just a big fat bastard that shoved cookies into your mouth like nobody's business.
But the thing is, though, they're not marketing that to you. They are marketing that to skinny girls who are perpetually on diets who go, well, I wouldn't eat cookies normally, but there's only 100 calories in here. And so now they're buying cookies they wouldn't be buying otherwise. Because, you know, that's what's going on in the think tank at Nabisco, is they're going, how can we sell cookies to these people who are on diets who aren't buying cookies? Oh, we'll convince them that it's okay because this bag of 4 cookies only has 100 calories. So then, of course, they have to buy the entire box that has 700 cookies in it. So they've bought cookies that they would not normally buy. And then they like take, if they have self-control, they take one to work every day and go, hee hee, I'm being good. I'm only eating 100 calories. Or the other like 60% of them are going home at night and eating all the cookies and then either hating themselves or throwing up in the bathroom.
Or quite possibly both.
Yes.
It's not like those are mutually exclusive activities. I don't even know where I was going after this. I will. One and a half more observations, and then we got to go to the news desk. We got Eric Snyder calling in at 2. We got Big Jim Willie coming in later on. We'll talk to our good friend Mr. Joe Squires, who's going to answer really just an increasingly series of ridiculous questions. Increasingly ridiculous series of questions from Don and I, because we have.
Well, you and I think electricity comes into the house via magic, and that it could kill us for no reason at all. That it could just leap out of the wall and kill us.
Well, that is true, by the way.
So,
I mean,
I don't see how anything we ask him is going to not be nonsensical.
It leaps out of the sky and kills people occasionally, so it's not like coming at you sideways is all that far removed from that scenario. I just sort of view electricity as being, I view electricity as functioning basically like my oil furnace, where there's just a big box of it somewhere, and then I like turn a knob or twist a dial or pull a lever and a thing goes, and a little cork comes out and it just sort of glugs into the tank until I'm done, and then I turn it off and it's, you know, whatever. Because I don't, it's like on the 1920s they would just They would just sell those plugs that you would stick into your outlet in the wall to keep the electricity from leaking onto the floor. And they sold that to people just like me. Except that was in 1920, and this is 2011. I still don't know how it operates. So we'll ask Joe Squire some questions about electricity. But before we do any of that, I get the following... I got one observation and then one brief story, then we'll go to the news desk. The observation is this. Here's the thing that I would buy, like today, sight unseen, if somebody were to market this. They got the whole, they got like apps and things you can use to count your calories. If you get like, it's like one of those supermarket clickers my mom used to carry as she would go through and just do her shopping at Safeway so she could add up about what it was going to cost when she went to the register. They got those sort of things for calorie counters, or they got like the little books you can, or you can scan a barcode and it'll tell you like how many calories some jazz is or whatever. But that's an inexact science. Here's what they need to make. They need to make a watch that you can wear that just measures the amount of calories you have actually ingested that day. I mean, there's got to be a way to do that, right? Because calories are energy. A calorie, in fact, is a calorie is the amount of energy that it takes to raise 1 cubic centimeter of water 1 degree, I believe. And so it is a form of energy, which means that it is demonstrable. By definition, it is measurable. So there's got to be, and they got those things you wear now, like if you're a diabetic, and it just like measures your sweat and says if you're about to pass out or whatever. I don't know why they don't measure a thing you could just wear, and you just look down at it, and it gives you a running tally for how many calories you've put into your mouth.
I'm not sure that a watch would really do that. Maybe something that you would have to actually have physically installed.
A dental implant
into
of some
your mouth.
Kind.
Yes.
Like one of those Japanese radios goes in your molar.
Yeah.
I'm not making that up, by the way.
Or some kind of a latex implant into your throat.
Or in your stomach lining.
Yes.
Maybe there was just some nanobots. They can do everything. If X-Files has taught us one thing, it's that every problem can be either solved or exacerbated by the use of nanobots.
Yeah, but then I start like thinking about Stargate. And whenever you get into nanobots, I start thinking about Stargate, and then I get scared. I think they're just going to take over everything.
And then Raquel Welch is in your colon.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Oh,
wow.
Sadly, I do.
I don't know if I have time to tell this horrific animal story.
Tell it later.
It's not even that the animal is ever horrific. It's just that it's me. It's sort of a sister story to that horrible thing you were talking about with your cat's anus. A couple of days ago. And I just didn't want you to feel... I'll just tell you real briefly, because I don't want you to feel alone in this sort of disgust and horror. So you on, I guess, Wednesday, you were talking about how you... It all had a happy ending, because you ended up not having to do this.
I was afraid I was going to have to express my cat's anal glands. So I went online and I looked it up on YouTube to see how you did it. And it was like the most horrifying thing I've ever seen in my life.
Because it's basically where your cat just becomes one of those like, your cat becomes one of those like icing extruders that you have to squeeze on top of it.
Except it's coming out of their butt.
Also,
oh my God, it was horrible.
Also, it's not icing in
no,
any way.
No.
So,
it's my understanding that it smells pretty vile as well. But you know, just watching it was bad enough.
So I will tell you this. So you told that, and I meant to tell this yesterday, but we got so terribly behind with everything that I wasn't able to do it. But you told that story, and I of course snickered because it was something bad happening to people other than myself. And I thought, well, that's great. Misfortune has befallen someone who's not me, Rick Emerson. It's therefore hilarious. Not unlike my excitement of jubilation to the news of someone's death earlier this morning. It's the particular halo of amusement that I wear around my head. So that night, I went to bed, and all seemed fine in the world. Everything was dandy, everything was wonderful, until the next morning when I woke up, and it was that thing of like, it was sort of like an elongated or somewhat delayed version of the guy in The Godfather where he wakes up and there's like the horse's head, but he doesn't quite realize it until he turns over and these sheets feel more viscous than normal. What seems to be going on? That is where I got up. And I stretch, and I like, that was a satisfying night's sleep. I can't wait to face the day, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, full of vim and vigor and glee. Walked into the bathroom, and I had gone to sleep because it was a little chilly. And I had gone to sleep with not just my normal crocodile boxer shorts, but I also had a T-shirt on. And I go into by the way, in retrospect, that's like a thank God for small mercies. I go into the bathroom, and I'm brushing my teeth or combing my hair, whatever I'm doing. And I look down, and it was a black T-shirt on, not unlike this one, and there was just this. And the thing is, I'm going to tell you something, and you're immediately going to come to some conclusion, and it's not the conclusion you're thinking of, but that doesn't really mean it's much better. I look into the mirror, and there's just this sort of a dark red, kind of dried spackling of something on the front of my shirt, and I think, Well, what is that about? And my first thought was, did I spill food on myself last night while I was eating? Because it's not like that's outside the realm of possibility. I mean, that happens probably, you know, no more than 10, 12 times a day. But I mean, it still could have happened right before I went to bed. And I was like, well, that's weird. It seems to be... Okay, well, it's on my boxer shorts, too. What the... Oh, it's on my ankle. And it was... And I couldn't quite figure out what it was. And of course, Laura was already long gone by this point. She'd gone up and gone to work. And so what apparently had happened is at some point during the night, the following chain of events had unfolded, that Max, our Stewie Griffin-like dog, had found an apricot. He had eaten the apricot, I think, possibly including the pit or the core or this or whatever is inside an apricot. He'd eaten the whole thing, I think. And that must have been relatively early in the night because it gave his body time to liquefy it into some sort of a pulp, but then to decide that it didn't quite agree with him. But then to decide... that rather than just waiting and expelling it out the other end, it would just try to get rid of it immediately by bringing it back up, you know, by going in through out through the indoor, as Led Zeppelin might say. But realizing all of this in such a sufficiently compressed time frame that he didn't really have time to get out of the bed. So effectively, he just hurled over and over again into the bed. In the spot, I think, where Lara had earlier been. She had gotten up, gone to work, and the way she told it later, the bed was fine when she got up. So I think she had gotten up and gone to work, and Max went, hey, nice warm place on the bed. Hey, what's that feeling on my stomach? Hey, right onto the... And then, of course...
Which did not wake you up somehow.
No, and I didn't wake up. And I also apparently... And I apologize for saying this, but we're outside the lunch hour, so what are you going to do? It's not like I can just share the good stories about the positive, uplifting things that happened in my life. But it also didn't wake me when I apparently, as you know, you do this if you share your bed with somebody and then when you're not there, you sort of, it's a combination of, I think, moving into the sort of, you know, the warm space and also just like, you know, and wrapping yourself up a little more tighter in the covers. So I moved into that and then I apparently just... It was like how Jesus, our Lord and Savior, was wrapped in swaddling clothes, but I was just sort of wrapped in vomit covers. And I think for the better part of the evening, because upon closer inspection, I was sort of wreathed in it. Like,
so you're just rolling around in dog barf all night.
It was like I was the maypole and his vomit was the twine.
That's,
you know?
Nice.
And it's just one of those things, and it's like you just, and at that point you just, like, you can't even really be horrified by it. Like, it's so disgusting. Like, it's like you're Bill Murray and he's just got the, you know, he's got the ectoplasm on himself. And you are so revolted that you reach a sort of, like, shrill numbness in your head. Where there's just, you know.
Yeah.
And at that point, you're just like, well, I guess this is how I look for a while. And I just went ahead and I fed the dogs and I, like, took them out and I did whatever. Just because, like, you know. You know, there's no point. Like, what am I going to do? Like, take the shirt off? Because it's like, that's just, you know, that's like step one of like 100 before you get in. You have to start scrubbing yourself with wire wool. All right. By the way, and whoever just typed this, no, you're welcome. That's one of the small services I provide. Yeah. Thank you for the vomit emoticon. All right. It is the Rick and Morty. See, the next time you feel bad about your life, the next time you suffer any sort of a crisis, a problem, a reversal, the next time things don't quite pan out the way that you thought they were going to, you say to yourself, have I expressed anal glands today? No. Have I woken up covered in the vomit of someone else? No. There you go. That's like two in the win column right there. You can't ask for a whole lot more than that in your life. Today, Penis Watch, Taser Watch, Jim Willig, clue number 5 of the E.H. Vending Name That Snack Contest, Eric D. Snyder calling from the Sundance Film Festival, and so forth. This, however, at the news desk is Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
I was unprepared. I was just thinking about dog vomit.
It's what I do. One of the many services I provide.
Honolulu emergency crews rescued a naked man from a trash chute of a Waikiki apartment building early Thursday morning. The call to 911 was made just before 4 a.m. A man was living on a 7th floor of an apartment building, called police to report that his roommate, who he said had been drinking heavily, physically assaulted him and threatened him with a knife. When officers arrived, the suspect ran and jumped into the trash chute. He lost his shorts on the way down and was stopped by the trash that had piled up to the 3rd floor, police said. This is when firefighters managed to pull him out. When asked how he ended up in the trash chute, the man said, "I went for a dive."
I don't understand.
Well, you know, apartment buildings, multi-floor apartment buildings will often in the hallway, there will be a chute that you can open up and you can throw your big bags of trash down the trash chute that goes all the way down to the basement to where the room is where they have the trash.
I didn't think those really existed. I thought that was a thing that was just
they exist.
Just there in like 1950s children's stories.
And this guy, apparently after drinking and assaulting his roommate and threatening him with a knife, the cops came. The guy jumped into the trash chute.
Is this like they have? Is this like if you go to like office buildings downtown, they'll have the letter drop, like the letter chute that's in the hallway or whatever. But they actually have a thing like that for trash. Because I remember, like you know, I think in the things set in New York, you know, you'll read things like in mid 20th century movies and novels and whatever would have a guy like in some tenement building with a trash chute, and then something bad would happen, like he'd have to dispose of a gun. Like Raymond Chandler novels always had a guy putting a gun down the trash chute. But it seems like there are so many problems involved with that because. Does it say how high the building is? Where was this?
He lived on the 11th floor, and he slid all the way down to the 3rd floor where the trash had...
Where was this?
Hawaii.
So, well, I didn't think they had... No, that's basements that they allegedly don't have in Hawaii, but I think we found out that they do. But if you have, like, an 11-story building and there's a trash chute, is it one... What am I trying to say? Is it one solid inaccessible tube from 11 down to the ground floor?
Pretty much.
Well, then what do you do if it gets blocked?
Well, they
that's why it seems like a bad idea, because what do you do if it gets clogged?
Well,
like if you put a bag, like you drop a bag of trash down there, and it just, somehow goes, it turns sideways and goes, and just sticks halfway down.
Well, you'd probably throw something heavy down to knock it further down.
This is why they don't put you in charge of building maintenance, by the way, because I knew you were going to say that, and that's exactly that's what you wouldn't do, because it would just if the thing gets wedged in there.
Joe Squires is sitting over here, and he's nodding that's what he would do.
Joe Squires, would you like to join us on the mic right now? Would you like to explain this, or would you like to do that later on? You want time to think about this? You want to have like a little final Jeopardy? We can sort of
stick.
All right, hold on. Let me just turn on the mic. Let me have you roll your chair over here. Joe Squires from Squires Electric is joining us in the studio today, ladies and gentlemen. Hello, Joe Squires.
Hi. Hey.
All right. So, if you are an 11-story building and you drop something, let's say it's a box that has just some cardboard and some crap and some whatever, it sticks halfway down, and then you're dropping other stuff on top of it. It seems like that might have the potential to wedge the thing further into the slot.
So it seems.
Yeah. Okay. How would you, if you were presented with this problem, what would you suggest as a method of solving this?
Like a garbage stick, like some sort of garbage pinata, if you're the maintenance man.
So would you, is there...
A garbage stick.
How would it, is there...
Think about this. The guy got trapped on the 3rd floor, so that means, on a pile of garbage, that means the people on the 2nd and 1st floor, when they open up their garbage chute, they see nothing but garbage.
So if there are openings on every floor for the garbage chute, then I guess you would go to the floor. You would go to the floor either directly above or below that, and that is where you would. You're doing the best motion, by the way. You're doing a sort of. You're doing the motion just like the guy in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre when he's jabbing Marilyn with the broom handle.
Yep.
So you would then jab it from, I guess, one floor above or below.
Or you just go. It says it had piled up to the 3rd floor, so you go all the way down to the basement and just start removing it, and he'll just. Come down as it lowers.
Where does that stuff go? Does it land in like a bin or an incinerator, or does it just like go down into a room that a guy?
I think
has to
they
come
go
empty?
Into bins because
into a dumpster.
Yeah, I think at one time there were incinerators, but there's so much stuff thrown away now that can't go into incinerators, and stuff's in plastic bags. So
guns.
So they go down into dumpsters. Guns.
You go right to guns.
Body parts.
You started it. Yeah,
that sort of thing. You don't want to incinerate.
All right. So there you go. I
used to have one. I used to live in a building that had one of those when I lived in Los Angeles. The building was built right after World War II, and we lived on the 5th floor. And yeah, you go out into the hall and you pull up the thing like in a mailbox, basically, and put it in there. And then I'd always stand there and listen to it going down because I just loved hearing it go bam, boom.
The thing I immediately think of whenever, because I was downtown at the it's that building that's right next to it's across the street from Macy's. It is directly across the street from the Starbucks at Pioneer Courthouse Square on the opposite side of Morrison. It's like the Columbia Building or whatever it's called. But I was in there, and it's like that building is it's one of those things obviously made in put up in 1890 or something. And you walk first of all. We must have just been a race of dwarves or something at an earlier point, because if you walk into a bathroom at a place like that, it's like going back to the bathroom at your old grade school, where suddenly it's like nothing. You just don't even know. Like the urinal seems like it's about 2 feet high, and like the stalls are all tiny, and you're just wondering if we were just like Lilliputian at some point. But they have the sort of the cool mail slot, and it's like I don't know why I immediately just visualize putting a baby down that, and I don't think I can be the only one that just thinks like what if I got a squirrel and taped a camera to him, and he's it's a thing that is. I never ever picture myself putting mail or packages or something that's got to be delivered. It
it's always
you just go straight to squirrel.
It's always like a squirrel, but he's outfitted with some sort of a device that can transmit the images. Because in my head, it's like a glorious sort of male transmitting netherworld inside there. Probably not an accurate representation of the situation.
Possibly not.
This is why they don't put me in charge of anything anywhere. Here's Don Taylor.
A former University of Cincinnati and NBA great is suing over the use of images of him in his college days. Oscar Robertson is suing the NCAA for using images of him playing for UC on current trading cards. Attorney Stan Chesley said that Robertson found out about the cards when fans started sending them to him to be signed. The lawsuit alleges that the NCAA and others have illegally licensed and received compensation for the images and likenesses of former college athletes like Robertson. Chesley said Thursday, they're using the UC logo and they're paying UC. They got the logo. They're not about ready to use the University of Cincinnati logo without paying for it, he said several times, repeating himself. In each of the 3 years at UC, Robertson won the national scoring title and was named All-American and was College Player of the Year. He went on to a 14-year career in the NBA. Said, why should the NCAA have the right to do this? He said, they just take it upon themselves to do this. And as Stan said, they contacted the University of Cincinnati about those cards, but not Oscar Robertson, Robertson said.
By the way, we should do one more here and we'll take a break. We'll come back on the other side. We'll talk to Mr. Big Jim Willig. He's going to be here with another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 today, talking about the life and work of Mr. Drew Carey. We'll also pepper our good friend Joe Squires with questions about electricity, as Scatman Crothers used to call it. I got to say this. We have here, this is from Bruce Agler. Usually goes into a, and then all caps, compactor. So he says you don't want to stay down there too long. So I think depending on the building and depending on what kind of waste they are anticipating, it either goes into a bin, an incinerator, or a thing that just mashes it down into a small sort of a...
Like on the Death Star.
Exactly, like the Death Star. Exactly.
Like on the Death Star.
I am so glad I'm not the only one that was thinking that. All right. Wonderful.
Ford Motor.
Why? Here's the funny thing about... The funny thing about the Death Star and their trash compactor is this. Is that... what is the reason we don't incinerate everything now, Don? Why isn't there just a big incinerator at the bottom? You just said it earlier.
Well, because there are things that you don't want to burn.
Why don't you want to burn them?
Because they're toxic.
Okay, but of course, what does the freaking Empire care about that? I mean, they're evil. Depending on which side of the equation you happen to be on. I like the idea that they are somehow going to the most bio-friendly solution to all of their trash issues, that they're not just dumping it out into space. Why wouldn't the Death Star just go, like, let's dump it on Alderaan, you know, or whatever? I mean, they clearly, like blowing up planets is somehow good for the interstellar ecosystem. I don't think so. So it just seems like, can't they just be shooting that stuff into the sun? Or just, you know, I don't know, just putting it in one of those, like, escape pods and shooting it down into the desert?
And why was there a monster in there?
You know, I don't really know, but there probably is some sort of fan fiction that explains it.
I will find this out, and on Monday we will do a
pop culture authority
about what's the deal with the monster in the trash compactor.
What do you think Navy ships do with their garbage?
Hey, that's a good question, actually. What do Navy ships do with their garbage?
They have a thing called the Big Ocean Theory. They just put it in bags, weight it down, and throw it over.
The Big Ocean Theory. Funny in several ways. The idea that they're not quite certain that it's a big ocean, that it's just sort of something they're speculating. And also, just that – is the idea just that there's – if I were trying to look for a plausible explanation for why the Navy would just sort of put it into bags and just sort of kick it off the side, there's one of two ways you could justify that to yourself. You could either say, A, that the ocean, not unlike the Earth and the universe themselves, that the ocean is effectively – it's just like a big washing machine on a slow spin cycle, and it will eventually clean everything one way or the other. Or B, that even if it doesn't clean this, the ocean is just so big and massive that the garbage couldn't possibly have any negative effects. If I were to ask them, which reason do you think they would give me?
Something in the middle of indifference.
Just go, we're the military. What are you going to do?
Oh, the ocean is so big, you can't prove it was us.
That's true. Okay, that's right. It could have been anybody. All right, fair enough.
Ford Motor Company posted its biggest profit in more than a decade in 2010. Sean McAlenden of the Center for Automotive Research.
Of the Clan McAlenden.
He says it's great. No, he says it's quite a comeback for Ford, considering it came its closest to bankruptcy of any of the Detroit automakers.
Let's see here.
They negotiated a very large loan before the credit freeze and have really fought all the way back on their own.
All right, so there's that guy.
Eric, so they're making a lot of money.
Eric Snyder is calling in at this moment.
Okay.
It is also 2:15, so it's worth asking at this point, Don. What is your gut sense on this? Do you believe we should take this call now and run later than we are, or should we take a little break, come back, try to do everything on the other side?
Let's take the call. If you want, I can go tell Mr. Willig that we're running a little bit behind, but
well,
you should start talking to him.
Let's be honest; he probably knows that at this point. So we'll stick around. So we'll stay here for a few minutes. We'll talk to Mr. Eric D. Snyder. Mm-hmm. He's at the Sundance Film Festival. Then we'll take a break. We'll come back with Big Jim Willig on the other side. Calling us live from Park City, Utah, where the Sundance Film Festival is approaching its apogee, ladies and gentlemen. Our good friend, Mr. Eric D. Snyder. EricDSnyder.com, also film.com, Cinematical, and Movie BS with Baron Snyder, heard Fridays, 11 a.m. in the noon at Cascadia.fm. Hello, sir. How are you on this fine Friday?
I am very good. Thank you. How are you?
I am fantabulous. What is your scorecard now for how many movies and how many days?
I believe I wound up at 25.
25
in, I guess that would be in 8 days, 25 in 8 days.
And so is this are these all feature films? Because they do a lot of shorts and everything there, too.
Yeah, no, those are all features. I saw a few shorts, too, but I try to avoid those. I don't like shorts. They're never short enough.
Once
they start being longer than 5 minutes, I'm like, no, this is not a short anymore. It's too long. Either make a movie or don't.
Am I the only one that finds the section of the Academy Awards where they're giving out the Oscar for the best short, whatever? It's just sort of irritating. It just sort of bugs you because it feels like that's you ought to be this long to ride this ride sort of a thing. Like you can come back and get an Academy Award and make a real movie.
And many short films are excellent, and I've enjoyed a lot that I've seen. But you know, I never seek them out. I feel bad for people who make shorts. Because no one pays attention to them.
Because they're mocked openly in the airwaves.
Yeah.
What is so the last time we talked to you, you had seen The Woman, which is from the folks who made the movie May. And I know that there was a lot of horror films at Sundance, but also a lot of other stuff that you know, is sort of notable or gaining a lot of attention. What have you seen since we last spoke to you? That
You saw Hobo with a Shotgun.
I did indeed see Hobo with a Shotgun. And it's more or less what you want from a movie called Hobo with a Shotgun. I think people feared that it would suffer from Snakes on a Plane syndrome, where it kind of goes downhill after the title. But no, Hobo with a Shotgun nails the tone of like the old bloody exploitation, the grindhouse kind of movies. Gets it right, sort of a parody, but not too winking, not too not too self-aware. But it's very fun.
And of course,
I think you will both enjoy that very much.
And Rutger Hauer is everything we want him to be.
He's terrific because you can tell that he gets what the joke is, but he's not playing the joke. He's completely straight faced. But it's not like Peter Graves in Airplane who didn't know what the joke was, didn't know that he was the joke. This is a guy, he knows what the joke is, and he knows that part of the joke is that he is supposed to not play it like a joke. He's very straight faced, and he's great. Yeah.
I know this sounds ludicrous to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What is Hobo with a Shotgun about? I mean, can you give us just like a thumbnail of sort of like, why does he have the shotgun?
Well, you see, it begins this way. When a hobo loves a shotgun very much, it's this guy, this hobo, riding the rails. It's set up a lot like the Clint Eastwood Man with No Name, Sergio Leone trilogy, where this hobo, nameless hobo, rides into town, this horrible Canadian town that's just gone to hell, just full of crime and corruption and violence and awfulness. And he's been there a few days, and he's had enough. And in the middle of he's in a pawn shop that's being held up, and there's a shotgun on the display. So he grabs the shotgun. He's had enough, takes matters into his own hands. And then it winds up being him versus the big crime boss in the city.
Let me just say this. Here's one of the things that you will never, ever, ever go wrong with in terms of Rick Emerson as a moviegoer. It's like we had that story the other day where it's like onlookers screamed in horror. That's the way that I know that I'm going to love a story. Or if an audience is stunned when a stunt goes awry, that's a thing that I'm going to love. I don't even need – I mean I can just bring that story in here without even going any further. Here's what I love in a movie. If it deals with a man who, quote, has just had enough – that's it. Doesn't matter.
Yep,
good guy, bad guy. It doesn't. Foreign, domestic. Yeah. I don't care. Movie with a guy who just wakes up and just goes, "That's it." Like that is.
That's
I'm
it.
Sold. That's all I need to know.
That is pretty much it. Yeah, and they have fun with it without being too without being too jokey. I love one of the after he's going on his rampage. There's a screaming newspaper headline that says, "Hobo stops begging, demands change."
I'm sold. When does that come out?
I don't know when it's going to be released, but it does magnet releasing happen. They will put it in theaters at some point this year.
Here's a dumb question, actually, because I don't know a lot about how the Sundance Film Festival sort of operates. So you hear a lot about movies that are being purchased. Are they, you know, like Kevin Smith, you know, was he auctioning up the film or what, wasn't he? And then there's, you know, people who, you know, they put out a press release that, like, you know, Lionsgate acquired our film and they're going to release it. If a movie plays at Sundance, do all the movies there, are they all without distribution? In other words, like, is Hobo with a Shotgun there and, like, somebody's still got to buy it and distribute it? Or is it, like, done and it's already coming out?
The way that it works ideally or theoretically is that all the movies playing at Sundance are for sale. They're all there to be part of a marketplace and all looking for distribution. The way it has evolved is that a lot of films come in with distribution already in place and they're just having their premiere at Sundance to get some indie street cred or whatever. Like Hobo with a Shotgun already had a deal lined up. Cedar Rapids, the new Ed Helms comedy. Fox Searchlight is releasing that like next month, but it premiered at Sundance. So there are a handful that are already set up, but for the most part, probably 80% of the movies playing there, they don't have a deal. They've been funded and produced and made somehow, and now they're hoping that one of the studios will come in and buy it and then put it in theaters. And this year was actually a really good year for sales. After a couple of years of the recession, this year something like I forget the number, but a lot of movies sold. And Fox Searchlight in particular bought like 7 or 8 films.
And so is it when you go to a screening, I mean, I know they do public screenings and critic screening, but when you go to a screening, is it a thing where literally like you're sitting in the theater and then like a guy from Miramax or whatever, you know, a guy from Lionsgate is sitting in the audience there also watching the film?
Yeah, the press screenings are actually called press and industry screenings. And so, yeah, there are people with industry passes. In fact, Silent House, the horror movie that I liked the first night I saw, Harvey Weinstein was in the audience with that. And he didn't like it. He was asleep for part of it and was sighing and tapping his foot the other part of it.
Just licking Cheeto dust off his fingers for the rest of the time.
those people are people from Weinstein's, from Miramax, from Lionsgate, Fox Searchlight, Sony Pictures Classics. Those are kind of the major players in this world. And yeah, there's often people from there trying to get a gauge for the audience reaction and stuff.
Heading into Sunday, I don't know how long you're sticking around for, but is there a sense of what's going to end up being winning the grand prize? I mean, is there any sort of like a talk about what the big winner's going to be?
It's weird. You asked that the other day, too, and I didn't have an answer, and I still really don't. Nothing has really popped out as being the big competition film, with an exception in the documentary category. The film How to Die in Oregon, about the right to die laws, is apparently, I didn't get a chance to see it, but apparently it's fantastic. I know Sean Levy saw it and loved it, and several other people have seen it and loved it, and there's a sense that that might win the documentary prize, which would be cool because it was an Oregon-made film and everything. And it's about how to die in Oregon, which is, I mean,
yeah,
we all need more suggestions. You know,
when you get back into town next week, whenever, we'll have to have you in the studio to talk more about this. So when are you
absolutely
seeing anything else? Are you headed back today? What is your schedule?
I'm actually done. I actually just got to my brother's house over in Pleasant Grove, Utah, where I'm going to stay for a couple of days, visit the family, visit my Utah bitches and hoes. And then I'll be back.
Excellent. Mr. Eric D. Snyder from ericdsnyder.com, film.com, Cinematical, and Movie BS with Baron Snyder, Fridays, 11 to noon at Cascadia.fm. Travel safe, my friend. We'll talk to you when you get back.
Thank you very much. See you guys later.
That is Eric D. Snyder. Awesome. It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. Thank you for joining us. I'm going to take a little break here. We are terrifically, tremendously, unbelievably over time. We're going to do this. Come back. We got Mr. Big Jim Willig coming up with Humor Me, Comedy 101. We still got your penis watch to get to, taser watch to get to, clue number 5 for E.H. Vendings, name that snack, and so forth. Stay there. The Rick Emerson Show continues right after this. Go nowhere.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Well, you know I can be found sitting alone. If you can't come around, at least please telephone. Don't be cool to your heart. Thinking of me, don't. make me feel this way. Come on over and love me. You know I want you to stay. Don't be cruel to a heart that's true. Let's walk down to the preacher. Let's say, hey, I do. And then I know you want me. And you know I want you to. Don't be cruel to a heart that's true. I don't want no. Don't be cruel to a heart that's true. Don't be cruel to a heart that's true. Don't need no other love. Baby, it's just you I'm thinking of. You know I want you to stay. Don't be cruel to a heart that's true. Why should we be apart? Baby, you know I love you across my heart. Don't be cruel to a heart that's true. Don't be cruel to a heart that's true. Don't be cruel. That's true. Don't be cruel to a heart that's true. I don't want no other love. Baby, it's just you I'm thinking of.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Many times I think that there'll be no one else. Our time will heal.
listening to the Emerson News Network.
Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. It is Friday, January 28th, 2011. Thank you for drawing near that ye might be amused and informed. Hello, Don Taylor.
Hi.
We'll have more news here in just a moment. Also, we're going to talk to our big good friend, Big Jim Willig. He's going to be doing another installment of...
Our big friend. Good Jim Willig.
Another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 today, talking about the life and career of Mr. Drew Carey. Also, Joe Squires from Squires Electric is going to attempt to, in some small, I really probably infinitesimal way, diminish the rampant vacuum that exists inside of our heads where knowledge about science and electricity ought to be.
It's Can you tell me what ohms are?
Maybe. I want to know what joules are. That's my whole thing.
Okay.
About when a guy says, like, well, this runs at 15 megajoules, and I just... And that's one of those things that, like, it could be... Megajoules could just be... It could be, like, a made-up word that all engineers and scientists, that they just got together in a room where there was, like, you know, one of the many meetings they all have, where they just decided just to use it to screw with the rest of us. Or, you
On top of everything else, it's French.
Or it was like...
So right there.
It's like the scoring system in tennis. They just did it to confuse the commoners. And it's worked. So, all of that. Plus, we'll have clue number five today for your EH vending Name That Snack Contest, plus a penis watch and a taser watch. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Radio Program our good friend, Big Jim Willig. Hello, sir.
Hello. Oh. I run at 14 megajoules currently.
Are you quoting something there?
No. I'm just...
The accent... I wonder if you were doing like a Doctor Who thing or something.
He's being fancy.
I'm being fancy.
I'm sorry. You're just being prim.
Yes, and I've got friends who are Masons. I know some of the lingo.
I know things.
I know how it goes down.
You know what I found out the other day? I found out that my father-in-law, Lara's dad, is a Mason, or was at one point, I guess. Which is strange because there was a whole thing... There was a thing for a while where... Mormons couldn't be Masons, and I think they may have either lifted that, or it was like he was sort of like undercover Mormon or whatever.
Undercover it's
like he
was sort of Mormon. That is the best reality show I would pay to watch.
I immediately was thinking, was it going to be the worst Charlie Pride song ever
Undercover Mormon.
Ill-advised follow-up.
So I was thinking, Undercover Mormon.
That's exactly what I was doing right there. Well done. I think it may have been before he converted, because he's like a lot of, and it's not like guys are the only ones who do this, but he was like a lot of guys where it's like he met the girl and they hit it off and whatever, and then she reveals later on, she's like, well, I'm a Mormon. And so then you just, you know. It's like Gilligan, where the camera goes, and then they cut to him going, sure, I'll be a Mormon, fine, and like signing up. But I think he may have already joined a Masonic lodge or something before that. But it was just one of those conversations where he was just, I don't know, he was just kind of sitting there like staring blankly at the television, kind of eating a Twinkie or something. And I said, so John, you're a Mormon. And he goes, yes, I am. And I said, so that really help you out in life? And he just said, nope, and just shoved the Twinkie into his mouth and went back to watching Fox. And that was it. So I didn't really, I got the sense it wasn't something he really wanted to talk a lot about. It didn't really work out the way he'd anticipated.
Being a Mormon's like killing a guy.
my father's best friend was a Mormon, and they were both on the fire department together. And I was at the fire station once, and I was probably about like 9 years old or something, and there were girly magazines lying around. And my dad's friend was holding like a Playboy magazine. And so I said, you know, Mr. whatever his name was, I said, you're Mormon. Yeah. Should you be reading Playboy? And he just looked at me and said, oh, I don't read it. I just look at the pictures.
That's pretty great. Well, you know, I mean, points for style and honesty, I suppose. There was for a long time, Masonic lodges, though, they would, I don't know if they would ask or if you had to reveal it. If there was like, I don't know if there's like some sort of a, if it's like the Scientology thing where they just like have you hold like, cans of Krylon and you answer a questionnaire or something, because they wouldn't – if you were a Mormon, they would not let you join because they were still so embittered about the fact that Joseph Smith ripped off all of the Masonic rituals for Mormon rituals.
Really?
Yeah. So if you – in the Mormon temple ceremonies, there's a lot of hand gestures and a lot of signs and signifying that you have to do. And it was all just – it was like all badly Xeroxed out of the Masonic playbook because Joseph Smith had been a Mason. And he's like, well, this new faith of mine needs to – it can't all just be crap I took out of a top hat. There's got to be a thing where you do a secret handshake. Who has it? Masons. And then he just immediately – so he was like the Stone Temple Pilots to their Pearl Jam, and they are so angry about it to this day that you can't – like, they wouldn't let you be one or the other. Speaking of which, I did – Joe Squires, I did bring for you a copy of the South Park episode All About Mormons.
I learned more about Mormonism that one night you and I sat in here and drank.
It's I brought that so you can – as you can watch it, because it is whole – it's fantastic and also wholly accurate, by the way.
It was quite hilarious when my husband was watching that the first time. Patrick and I were sitting there watching it, and I had just read the Crack Hour book.
Under
the Banner of Heaven. And in fact, I still had the book from the library in the other room, and we were watching the South Park episode, and Patrick was just laughing and laughing, and I said, you realize that this is actually what they believe,
yes,
right? And he's like, what? I said, oh, yeah. And I went and I got the book, and I was reading him stuff out of the book. He's like, no.
Yeah.
I said, oh, yes, no. It's that's really what
I get all
believe.
My news from The Daily Show, and I get all my religion-based information from South Park. No, so
I wonder what's happening with the musical they were working on.
I don't even want to say it.
Oh.
I don't even want to see if that thing. I say it a lot. I'm going to F myself.
Okay.
It's just not going to work out. Hold on. Let's see.
And all that vague sound effect implies.
I was going to flip a coin. Hold on.
Might you, in a professional capacity, be?
Let me look into the top hat and see what the top hat tells me. Okay, it says I can reveal. I may or may not be seeing a pre-premiere, a late-stage rehearsal of that. So that is
you suck.
That is
awesome, but you suck.
I don't want to say that it's definitely going to happen. I may or may not be seeing I don't know what they call that, but it's right before, you know, it's like a dress rehearsal right before they get to curtain or to, you know, whatever, to the premiere of it. So that may or may not be happening in March.
Okay.
So I will be sure to let you know because I will be jumping out of my skin,
yes,
with excitement if that does come true. And of course, then I'll also be calling in to kind of give the good word. Maybe I can catch the Spider-Man thing while I'm there too. How awesome would that be?
Yeah,
make it sort of a 1-2.
Yeah, your life is great.
Yeah,
I'll be here in Portland.
Cue the train.
Seriously, that train which we add in post for atmosphere. By the way, that's just that just comes out of our SFX library for ambience.
Yeah, we're actually in a fallout shelter right now, deep within the Utah. The Salt Flats.
I don't even know what we were talking about. So Jim Willick will be doing, in just a few minutes, we'll be doing another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101, talking about Mr. Drew Carey, Joe Squires from Squires Electric in the studio with us. Well, let me do me, have you get a little closer to that mic, kind of get right up on it there.
Sorry, I'm the new guy.
If you get, it's the difference between these two mics is this mic you can pull back a little bit, that when you get too far, and it sounds like you're just like you're inside like a Hills Brothers coffee can. So let me ask you this. About electricity. Dawn, do we have a taser watch?
We do indeed have a taser watch.
We're going to ask you a question about tasers and about electricity and about the way that it gets, you know, out of the taser, through the whatevers, you know, the cables into the human body just a second.
I knew I was in for something. Written on your board is penis taser.
Well, that's later on. That's only if you disappoint us in your answer. That's our own Japanese game show that we're running in here.
Penis taser!
Laughter.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
So shall we go directly into the taser watch?
We shall indeed. Here is your taser watch for Friday on the Rick Emerson radio program. Here is Dawn Taylor with your taser watch.
On Friday night, police officers in Chickasha, Oklahoma, had to deal with a suspect so unruly they tasered him at least 11 times before taking him into custody.
Chickasha sounds like a place that was just created by Hank Williams Jr. so you'd have stuff to rhyme in a song.
Just outside of Greater Tuna.
Police were called to a domestic dispute at a Chickasha home Friday night. Oddly Inside, enough. They found 27-year-old Dennis Ray Maloney Jr. of Lawton, Oklahoma. Police say Maloney was undressed and unruly. Lieutenant Dan Persky of the Chickasha Police Department said he just kind of snapped, became violent, and the wrestling match was on.
Oh, my God. It's like this story is created of nothing but the best parts of other stories. Well, first of all, undressed and unruly, it's like they're just writing the news story based on Jeff Foxworthy album titles or something.
Where was the drinking in there?
Lieutenant Persky...
Probably earlier, I would imagine.
Well, the previous news story mentioned he was intoxicated when he jumped into the garbage chute.
That's true, yes. Well, I'm sure there was drinking here involved,
If you're shirtless and the police are called...
I mean, this is sort of the thing that, like... Oh, I'm sorry. I'll let you finish because I...
Lieutenant Persky is one of two officers punched during the scuffle. There were no serious injuries. It took three police officers, three taser guns, and numerous jolts to get Maloney into custody. Persky said, normally the taser is very effective. People want little of it. They get right up and they're ready to go to jail.
It's the very definition of the do not want.
Police say that they suspect that Maloney was under the influence of drugs.
No.
Which is why it took 11 tasings to get him. He's now charged with felony assault and battery.
So let's just count the great phrases here. A, that he was undressed and unruly. B, that they had to tase him 11 times. C, that the wrestling match was on. D, that the taser's a thing. People want very little of it.
Yes.
That's sort of an interesting
Which then he follows by saying, people get right up and are ready to go to jail.
The phrasing of that sentence is a little interesting, too, because it implies that it's like you don't – it's not that you want none of it. You just want a little bit, you know, just enough to sort of, you know, like maybe you got like an itch of some kind that won't quite go away. Or there's a place in your back you just can't quite reach, and they just give it a good tasing, and then you're done.
Makes me think that next to that news story was like a yokel Mad Lib where like you have to sort of like fill in various keywords to make the story kind of complete.
Chickasha. Is Chickasha the county or the city?
That is the city. Chickasha, Oklahoma.
Ah. Isn't that one of the – is it Chickasha? Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I realize that the Dukes of Hazzard is not like a documentary, but isn't Chickasha the county line that they were always having to run to?
Maybe.
To get across? Like, well, once you can get into the – once you're across the Chickasha county line, Sheriff Little can't – and there was
a huge – Shelbyville.
There was a huge black man named Sheriff Little, and he was the guy that they would occasionally stray into his county.
I believe you're correct.
And he was like humorless. He wasn't a Roscoe P. He wasn't going to cuff you and stuff. He was going to kill you and bury you. And it was like, and they would always do the thing of like making it back across the Hazzard County line. And they would look back and there's Sheriff Little, like, because he was tough but fair.
Like the sheriff from Porky's.
Exactly. And he was standing there.
Throwing his hat on the ground.
You're going to fit in perfectly, Joe Squires. Yeah, no, he was standing there, and he had – it wasn't the hat on the ground. He had – I think he was in a car, but for some reason he always had, like, the Chips helmet on. And he would stand there at the county line, which I swear to Christ, it was like that line that they would draw on the – it was like that line that Foghorn Leghorn would draw on the ground where the dog couldn't get past. And he would just stand there, and he would throw his helmet down. And he would turn and walk away, and the Duke, you know, and then Waylon Jennings would wrap everything up.
Well, I don't remember that. I watched a lot of Duke Brothers.
Here's the thing: you don't remember that because your brain is filled with actual knowledge of science and electricity. My brain has no need for I have all kinds of room left over to file away things, you know, about like Ruth Buzzy sitcoms from the 1970s.
Well, Chickasha has a population of over 15,000. It is the county seat. Of Grady, Oklahoma.
Over 15,000.
Gravy, Oklahoma.
And it is Grady, not gravy.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I love the dog.
No, no, no. Less.
And among the highlights of Chickasha, it is the location for the Chickasha pre-war swap meet every year.
Of course it is.
How can there be a pre-war swap meet? Are they really disagreeable people?
It is a significant swap meet for owners and collectors of cars manufactured before 1942.
Do they have like the largest ball of twine north of the Mason-Dixon line or anything?
It's the largest musket ball.
Notable people from Chickasha include Chet Allen, who co-starred in NBC's The Troubleshooters.
When the top of the list is nobody I know.
I think the guy in this story really is the most notable person.
Sam Rayburn, defensive tackle for the Philadelphia Eagles, came from Chickasha, Oklahoma.
Oh, great. It's another reason for me to be shamed about my favorite football team. Great.
All right, so here's the question, Joe Squires. Here's the question that we have. Let me get the appropriate – hold on. Let me just
Okay.
Then we'll just do this. All right. So you've heard us talk many times about Squires Electric. You can find out more about them, by the way. It's SquiresElectric.com. com or 503-252-1609. And so we have referenced you a lot as a guy who you know stuff, and not in a Fredo Corleone kind of way, in an actual kind of way. Here's a question we have about tasing and tasers. Why does it take sometimes like 11 times to bring a guy down and sometimes like once? Now, I know that they always go to the drug thing, but doesn't it seem like if there's like – because a taser has how many like volts or whatever? Like your average taser, how many volts could you give a guy safely to bring him down without killing him, do you think?
Boy, well, I know it's the amps that kill you, so
– okay, so –
I don't know.
So the difference between
Don, let's Google that.
The difference between like watts and volts, because those are two different things too, right?
Yeah.
Okay. What is the difference between wattage and voltage?
Wattage is a relation of it's amperage times voltage.
Okay, that doesn't help me at all.
It's
wait.
Like, okay, it's like
if one is a potato it's like and the other is a chicken,
it's like a parsec.
Like
it's
if
not,
you have a,
it's not a distance. It's a
yeah. If you have a 60-watt light bulb, you know, like in your standard house. And your house is at 120 volts. That means it draws half an amp. It's just a ratio.
Okay.
Still lost. Still
really?
Completely.
No,
let's
you know
go back to the Duke Brothers.
You know what I feel like? Here's what I feel like. I feel like Steve Martin and the Jerk when he goes, "It's a profit thing." Suddenly, except without the moment of revelation.
Kramer and Seinfeld. It's a write-off, Jerry.
Yeah, I have no idea how this actually works.
What we need is someone like the Miracle Worker to kind of come in, take the actual knowledge, find a way to make it palatable for someone whose brain is as differently wired, we'll say, than yours. Because yours, you're actually built for absorption of knowledge in that capacity. I see it as when you're born, your brain has got so many blank VHS tapes to be able to record knowledge onto. What you do with that, what space, is up to you. We chose to use that with pop culture knowledge. He took it with actual viable information that could be used later on to benefit him financially.
Now, trust me, my head's filled with useless knowledge, too. I mean, I'm your best teammate on Trivial Pursuit.
My head is just filled with Mama's Family episodes. That's it. That's all.
That's above me.
Yeah,
I know about nothing other than cartoons and snack food.
What else is there?
Here's a question, though. If you're tasing a guy, doesn't it seem like if one of your guys was out working and he got hit with whatever, like how much? Maybe ask you this: how much voltage or whatever amperage? What would it take to knock a guy down?
I mean, in most of your residential houses, there's 120 volt.
Okay.
I mean, in all of them, actually.
And how many amps?
200 amps for most houses. Older houses might be 100.
And it's the amps that are dangerous.
Yeah,
that's the thing
that'll... Yeah, it's
the amps. Okay, so how... you know, a taser's got to be at least that if it's designed to incapacitate
I would imagine a taser has, you know, I don't know, let's say 2,000 volts and, you know, 0.001 amps.
Dawn?
She's taking notes like we're going to be college credit for this later.
Have you Googled this yet?
No, I just looked up this thing where I looked up an actual thing about stun guns, and it said, choosing a taser is easier than you might think, and then it made no sense to me.
Well, this is a guy, I mean...
So I don't know.
Yeah, I've seen people get tasered before. I mean, not in person, but, you know, like... You know, watching The Hangover.
And, yeah.
I mean,
in the face.
And it just seems, I sure wouldn't want to get up from that. So.
You watch it the same way I do. You just troll YouTube for people that are asking for it.
Yeah.
And then who then?
Want none of it later.
Yeah, want none of it
yeah.
later.
The dart firing tasers are 50,000 volts.
50,000? Whoa.
So the question that we have, though, is why sometimes tasing like you tase a guy once and he's fine, but then you got this guy, it's like they tase him 11 times. And so can there be that much variation, or is it just – it doesn't seem like drug schmug. It's like, you know, if your heart stops beating.
I would imagine. I mean, if you're wet, if you're sweating, you're going to get more of a zap.
Well, there's also
this guy's got his shirt off, so.
I guess obviously there's the whole like you know electricity finding a way to ground. So if it comes through you,
it has
to find a way to.
This has two probes that stick you, and then the path of current is through you.
Okay.
So there's no ground. It's going through you.
Okay. So if you only get hit by one of the barbs, then
nothing would happen.
Sweet.
So they got to hit you with. So that's why sometimes
you just have to matrix your way out of one of the barbs, and you're fine.
Nice. Good visual too there, Jim.
It's the closest thing I get to cardio.
Okay. Here's another question I have. Does the taser have to have two barbs to work? Could you make a taser that just worked with shooting one barb? Do you think?
Boy, if I said something and your listeners are going to chime in, it's my understanding it has to have two barbs.
No, let me tell you this right now. The listeners already respect you because you know watts and amps and volts.
I actually have some kind of what seems like a real answer, and it is from an actual police officer here. So police tasers have 50,000 volts, but that is not harmful. Amperage is what is deadly. Tasers have less than 0.2 amps, which is 30 times less than a lethal dosage of 0.7 amps. Stun guns have fixed contact points. Tasers fire probes. The probes are more effective because they can lock up your muscles if they're separated by more than 4 inches.
Okay, so there it is.
Stun guns cause a lot of pain, but they don't incapacitate a person.
So he's saying, I don't like to defibrillate you. It takes between 4 and 7 milliamps. So, I mean, what he's saying is, what did he say, 5, 7 milliamps? Boy, this is a little too serious for our show.
No. Trust me. This is the sort of thing that fascinates me because I like to know stuff.
He kind of verified the further away the probes touch, you know, get you on the one that has the wire.
Right.
The more it, you know.
Okay. So it could be something where it was like a close company.
So if it hits you, in your two shoulders, it's going to go across your chest, and it's gonna.
Say he gets hit in the arm or the leg, and it's only like maybe a few inches apart.
Then you might get a Charlie horse in your leg.
All right. Yeah. So let me ask you. So here, okay, is this because stuff like this, like, I keep this in a file in my head called things that I want to know at some point. And then the first time I have the opportunity to like drill somebody for this information, I go until I feel like I've got as good a handle on it as I'm going to get. So it shoots out the two barbs. One of them is wired. The other one is basically just a receptor to pair with the first one, right, like a Jacob's ladder almost.
Yeah, exactly.
And so if you had a Jacob's ladder, which is that thing you see in the Frankenstein movies where it goes zzz and the arc rises over and over again, if you just had one of those, the wired barb would have nothing with which to pair, and there would be no, for lack of a better word, arcing between the two.
Correct.
It is the internal arcing between the two that acts as a paralyzer on your muscles.
Correct. So, like, if one barb hit you, you know, and the other one missed you, or if you were at a great distance and one barb, you know, got lodged in your shirt instead of touching skin,
because it wouldn't then be able to, it wouldn't
be
able to,
isn't conductive.
Because your shirt isn't conductive, and so unless the shirt had, unless you were
wetting,
if the shirt was really wet, the water might conduct,
or if you're sweating, something
okay,
like that.
Or
right,
if you're wearing one of those newfangled Japanese shirts that is hooked up with the magical fibers that can attract Wi-Fi.
Perfect segue.
Or that, sure, yeah, okay, fantastic, awesome. Next thing we're going to ask, just because this is a thing that's just going to has just not plagued us, but it's fascinated us for a long time. So, Joe Squire, so you worked on a nuclear submarine, when you were in the Navy, and we were sitting in your office at one point, and this is, I think, right before you revealed that you possessed a box of New Kids on the Block trading cards.
Oh shit!
This is right around that same time.
There's a lot of peels to this onion that we are peeling back at this point.
He's a multifaceted individual.
Joe Squires is a complex man.
It was a gag I got.
No, we understand. No, yeah,
no,
a gag.
Really,
but
yeah. Danny's, sure.
but Donnie's my favorite.
Of course.
Well, because Danny's just weird looking.
Dude. He's the monkey faced one.
He really is. That's unfortunate. He looks like he escaped from some sort of a research laboratory somewhere, or that's just one of those things. You know what? You know what? You know what he looks like? Danny would have sort of like. It's like when we got our second dog, Philo, and he was very, you know, he's a puppy. He was very young. He was like just a couple months old. And my wife referred to him. He was sort of he was like the great white hope of our household. My wife referred to him as being like a calendar dog because she thought that he was going to grow up to be good. Because Max is sort of small and cute, but he's got like he's like missing some teeth and he's got like an odd eye and he's like he's good
and he's evil.
His tongue doesn't quite fit into his mouth and he's evil. And so her whole thing was
is he a cage fighter?
And it's like every photograph of him, you know, it's like you can just see these. He's gone a little wonky in some ways. And so her whole thing was like Philo was going to be the dog that you could put on the Christmas card, the dog that you could put in the guidance counselor's office with a thing saying, "Is it almost Friday?" And he'd be adorable. But it's like by the time he was a year old, we realized that he was just put together from just leftover bits and sticks and twine and just incompetence. You know, he just ended up being not at all, you know. And that's what Danny Wood is in the New Kids on the Block, where they found five young kids and they said, these guys are all going to be heartthrobs. And then later, oh, no.
Some marketing genius thought putting a goatee and some glasses on him, some sunglasses, would solve the problem.
Did not work.
Well, it's like that old adage where, you know,
this is what Rick's dog looks like,
oh,
by the way.
Wow.
Yeah, he's awkward.
Oh, wow.
There's a lot of debris caught in that mustache.
Yeah, he's perpetually confused about everything.
So does that dog jump up on your lap and lick your face?
He spends a lot of time staring blankly at walls.
Okay.
And then the other day he actually, I swear to God, he ran away from a baby. So you know that's how he rolls.
Dog voted most likely to eat paint.
So my question for you is, having worked in a nuclear submarine, so you're there and there's the nuclear submarine. When they say it's a nuclear submarine, what does that mean exactly in terms of, like, is there plutonium inside or is there some sort of
uranium? The reactor's uranium. They're built. It's in a core, and then they insert graphite rods into it to slow down the process of you know, the uranium. Uranium splits. There's neutrons that come off of it. It's a fission process.
And then at some point they prepare you for the possibility, or I guess maybe the risk. Although they try to avoid this sort of thing. But where there's some sort of a rupture or a
breach.
Breach of the hole. What is the worst case scenario there? I mean, that sounds dumb, but I mean, is it literally like a split or a crack or?
Well, there's redundancies after redundancies. If things got a little too hot in there, then they have something called scram the reactor, where there's magnetic coils that hold the graphite rods that, you know, slow down the process. If things got a little too hot in there, the magnetic coils release and the graphite rods slam into the uranium and it shuts
the reaction.
Shuts it down, and you'd be without power.
Is there now? If you're without,
because you don't just turn the key and start it up.
I was gonna say, you don't just throw like baking soda on it, like, oh, it's fine now.
Roll it down a hill.
The graphite absorbs the neutron or the neutrons, which accelerate the process.
Well, this just leads to more questions. So if you shut down the reactor and then you're without power, but then you're in a submarine that has no power, so that seems bad.
You have some battery backup.
Okay,
a little bit of battery backup.
How long is the battery backup good for?
That's classified.
To
be honest, it's been a long time. I forget.
Oh, I see. You could just tell me it was classified, and I'd be impressed, and also
I'm not sure if the men in black jackets are going to storm through the door either.
I always wonder about that, though. Like, if you're, you know, you always hear, like, you see the gray lady down thing, where it's like, damn it, they've only got 14 minutes of power.
What was interesting is, I remember, like, one of my first days at nuclear power school in the Navy.
Nuclear power? Is that not the coolest school? I'm late for nuclear power school.
Yeah.
That's actually pretty
sorry,
cool.
Baby. I'd love to stay, but I got to go learn about nuclear fission and chain reactions. Also, how to stop a core breach. I'll be back a little later if you want to hook up.
Yeah, it was in Orlando too. What a better, no better place to go to school.
But really?
The design of the reactor, I remember they said, was skew divergent, and that was classified.
Well, I don't even know what that means.
It's how the.
Wait, did you just reveal something classified on the show?
Probably.
Awesome. All right, fantastic.
Skew divergent.
Fortunately, no enemies of our nation listen to the Rick Emerson show.
I can't afford it.
I get this feeling like somewhere there's a guy with those glasses where one's like got an eye patch on it built in, and he's writing our names down on a piece of paper.
No, it's
Willing.
Your Patriot Act. There's certain words they're looking for. Osama bin Laden, skew divergent.
And we great. Let's just tag them all right now.
Yeah.
You told me at one point that they, when you were trained, how long, okay, when you're in nuclear power school, how long does that, I mean, that's like a mail order course, you know?
Two years of training.
This sounds stupid, but what kind of things do you learn at nuclear power school?
You know what's fascinating? I mean, they teach you, I mean, it's a lot of physics, and then you go to a prototype. There's three prototypes around, one Idaho, Connecticut.
Uh-huh.
There are actually mock-ups of submarines buried.
Is it like the Blueback, but it's in the ground?
Yeah, but it's in the ground, and the Blueback's a diesel sub.
Okay.
Because what's the worst that could happen to a submarine that's landlocked?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's buried underground, and they call it prototype, and then you go through different, you know, things that go wrong. You know, they have mock fires, they have mock floods, yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Is it like Star Trek where they put Kirk in the Kobayashi Maru?
The Kobayashi effect. He cheated. He reprogrammed.
Reprogrammed the sub.
I've never lost.
See, here's the thing. I know that you said a minute ago that the audience won't like me, dude. You have no idea how much
one of us.
They're going to carry you out of here on their shoulders like Bruce Lee.
Well, when we both.
By the way, he looks a little like Nathan Fillion too. Just in case you want to know.
For you ladies,
when you throw out the Kobayashi effect, and I'm picking up what you're putting down.
Yeah.
We're on the same.
We're of a mind here. You are of the body.
I've always loved your show, just because of all those little drops and nuggets.
You're there in the sub, and is it literally where there's a guy like at a control board somewhere, and he goes, well, run a number six on him, and it's like they press that, and that's where, like, I don't know, it's like you're taking in water, and also there's no power, and plus, like, somebody's microwaving metal, and you've got to, like, figure out how to fix it all, or.
Well, I mean, it's fascinating when you think about it. I mean, a submarine goes out to sea. Everything that you need, they make. I mean, you make your own air. You boil water. You boil seawater hard enough. It, you know, breaks up in hydrogen.
Right.
Hydrogen. You have your own oxygen. You pump the hydrogen overboard. So you make your own air. So it's the purest of air.
You make your own air.
You make your own water. You boil seawater. You discharge the brine over, and you have pure water almost. The only thing, you know, make your own electricity. The only thing that limits you is how much food you can carry. So, I mean, when you first start off, I mean, there's food everywhere. It's stacked in the hallways.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you're underwater. I mean, technically, shouldn't you be able to grab some fish, you know? Would you have one of those cast a net out?
That was the ruinization of the Polish Navy. They'd open the door up.
Wow. Or just, I just picture like one of those, like, what are those like boxes like Homer Simpson uses where it's the gloves that go into the box to handle the, you just one of those out of the side of the ship and there's a grouper that goes by and you go, oh, there you go.
Got it.
An eel.
We eat tonight.
I swear to God, first of all.
Well, what's fascinating, then you come ashore, you know, you're underwater for 3 months, you come ashore and, you know, within a couple of days you have a cold because.
Because you haven't been exposed. You've been breathing perfectly clean air. It never occurred to me that you would or even could make your own air or water. I guess maybe I could have figured that you could have removed the salt or something from seawater. But the making your own air.
Yeah, water, H2O, you boil it hard enough, it breaks up into hydrogen. Hydrogen's explosive, so you compress that, and then you go down deep enough, and you discharge it overboard, so the bubbles, by the time they, you know,
you make it sound so simple. Like if we gave you a box of parts, you can make a sub.
If you're breathing your own air, you'll see the thing in movies sometimes where people they have the oxygen and it makes them high or giddy or whatever. Does that happen if you're breathing pure air that you've kind of made yourself on the sub?
Not really. I mean, they scrub it. I mean, you know, to get rid of the
carbon.
Well,
they're not breathing pure oxygen.
No,
they're...
it's, you know, and then we carry nitrogen.
So it's a mixture. Okay.
So you break it. You have the oxygen. Our air is, you know, 22% oxygen and the rest nitrogen. You know.
So. Okay. So you're making your own mixture. Yeah. And then, but it's pure. It's free of impurities. There's no, you know, not the crap that you'd be breathing in if you're on the surface.
We bring with us compressed nitrogen and then we make the air. Yeah.
Will you be on my geek trivia team next Tuesday?
Seriously.
Absolutely. I love that stuff.
Don't take this the wrong way. Will you just live in a little box in the corner of the studio?
And 80s music is my strength. Ask me anything about Depeche Mode.
Okay, that sounds like a challenge to me.
We are so going to kick Dave Walker and Courtney Hameister's asses next week.
And not just that, you are coming back on this show next week, and we're going to have a little bit of a music face-off here in the studio. We're going to come up with some sort of a like pick your three Jeopardy categories contest, and it'll be like you and Don, or you and me, or you and somebody.
I have this thing where I love, like, a song will come on, I'll be like, oh, that's, you know, Welcome to the Jungle, song number one off of,
You do the label and the year of release and the everything, yeah.
I mean, because, yeah, you can kind of associate music with where you were in life. And like a, you know, like a 6 months ago, my wife's like, all right, I'm calling BS. There's no way. I went to the pantry, got the CD, pointed to the album, and she's like, okay.
Well, that's, you know, but again, that is a rarefied, that's a form of knowledge that people will tell you never, ever comes in handy. They could never use for anything, which is true almost all of the time.
The Cliff Clavin factor.
Yeah. That it is true. Basically, really, I am in like one of the two jobs that exist on Earth where that knowledge actually comes in handy, where you can
Trebek.
Yeah, that really is it. Because the rest of the time, it's just some guy. Because if you don't end up doing this or being Mark McGrath and hosting that show, that you're just sitting on you're just the guy. The only other job you can get is the guy sitting on the sofa at home going, oh, he's wrong. Oh, come on. I could totally win this show.
I'm still waiting for Mark McGrath to end up in B-porn.
I'll let you know.
Yeah, I was going to say, Jim is the man to ask about that. When Jim is not bringing comedy to the good people of Portland, he actually works at one of Portland's finer adult emporiums.
Oh, I thought you meant like you're a stunt double or something.
Well, only partially.
But we all have a dark secret there, Mr. Squire.
He's a hand model for porn.
He's a hand model.
Final question, and we got to get underway only because at some point Greg and Sarah will rush the studio.
We don't want to make Greg mad.
You
don't want to see him angry.
The supply of hams gets cut off then, and then it's just, you know, doesn't go anywhere. You mentioned at one point that they taught you how to stop a nuclear fire or a steam leak or something. It was like a belt and a mattress and a thing and a whatever.
It's everything on your body is usable. It's just like you carry a the shirt you wear. If you get thrown in the ocean, you hold it up over your head and you inflate it. You know, you pull the shirt.
You do that. I die screaming like a child.
Your boots are waterproof. You undo your boots and tie them in a knot and put them in air and hold them under your pants. You take your pants off. You tie the ankles together and use them as a flotation. Oh, I mean,
okay, fine. Hey, survival man.
I was a Boy Scout. We had to learn that.
And they make you train. I mean, you're in a pool in Orlando.
Yeah.
I mean, and they make you jump off fully clothed and do it. I mean, it's kind of interesting. And in one of the things. I mean, there's a steam leak and at prototype, and they make you stop it.
And it's like out of a pipe, out of like a water pipe or out of
high pressure. Okay. Steam runs pretty much everything on the boat. I mean, it turns, turns a rotor where it makes your electricity,
right.
And the solution to it is to grab a mattress, to come in with the mattress, to wrap it around the pipe, and then to tie it down with your belt.
And is that actually, and that'll actually hold it for however long for?
It'll hold it till you can surface, I guess.
Wow. So. How long can you, all things being equal.
Do you run out of mattresses and belts?
Who can we lift and fold?
I mean, if it gets to that, it's bad news.
Okay, I have one very important question for Joe Squires. When the zombie apocalypse happens, where do you go?
Ooh,
where
are you headed? Done.
I go to my basement where I keep my guns.
Because I was going to say you go into the submarine, but then there's a whole debate about whether they can just roam the ocean floor.
I sure hope they're the slow zombies, like Woody Harrelson's Zombieland, and not the 28 Days zombies.
No, those aren't zombies. We call those infected. That's the decision we've come to.
That's scary stuff.
Because you go at a geek trivia night, and it's like I have seen grown men just be like an inch away from each other, seriously, about whether they're not zombies.
They're infected, damn it.
Exactly. That's the whole thing. If they can run, they're infected.
That was a scary, scary movie. Okay, the original.
Night of the Living Dead?
Night of the Living Dead. Thank you. Wow, it's like you're inside my head. The original Living Dead was on from the 60s, the black and white version.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On the other day. Horrible, horrible movie.
Well, there's that whole sequence where the girl's like lunching up on her mom, too.
Yeah.
That's all kind of. Did you ever see the stage play of that? They do it here. They do it. They took a year off, but they do it every year. It's a theater company. They're called the Blue Monkey Theater Group. And they do every year. They do a live stage play, a stage adaptation of Night of the Living Dead, which you listen and you go, well, how could that? And it's amazing. And they bill it as a black and white play. And you say, well, what are you talking about? And the production design, the color scheme of the play is such, and the lighting, that everything, to whatever degree they can do, everything looks black and white.
The clothes
are black and white. The set is black and white.
Wow.
The lighting is done through filters to make it look as though you're watching a black and white movie. And they do basically, they pre-record brand new versions of when they're watching the newscaster on TV and he's, and they're doing, an army of undead, we have received reports that corpses are walking. They re-record that just for the play, but they insert Portland city names and everything, in Roseburg, in, Ashland. In Portland. And as you're watching the stage, and I can tell you the sound is not a spoiler because it doesn't matter because it's still going to freak you out. When you're watching the stage version of Night of the Living Dead, what you do not realize but then eventually discover to your horror is that as you are watching the play, zombies slowly start filling the aisles of the theater. And my wife and I went to see it, and I didn't know this was going to happen. I'd interviewed the guys who run the theater company, but they're like, we act out all the action, and we take a little intermission, but we do the entire Night of the Living Dead thing on stage. And I was like, that's awesome. And I was all just taken in how the set looks black and white, and it's really cool. And then at one point, it's like I just catch something in my peripheral vision, and it's a darkened theater, of course, because they're doing a play. And you just see these, silhouettes just sort of, moving in the background. And then eventually they start, they're in the aisles next to you, and then one will occasionally stumble down a row of seats and then just sort of stare at you for a while. And it's really, really freaky. It's deeply unnerving. I strongly recommend anybody see that when Halloween comes. They do it every October.
Hold me, Jim. I'm scared.
Only if you hold me.
Okay.
I think we saw the beginning of a beautiful new relationship today.
Or an exciting sitcom spinoff.
He's a genius. He's an idiot. Can they make it work? Find out Saturdays at 5.
He knows how to fix a nuclear submarine. He works at a porn store.
We're talking with Joe Squires from Squires Electric. Again, you can find out more about them at squireselectric.com or 503-252-1609. It's time for another exciting installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 with our good friend, Mr. Jim Willig.
Thank you very much, Rick Emerson. Well, childhood is a difficult time for everyone. Everyone, that is, except for the popular kids. Their high cheekbones and perfect skin, properly working metabolisms, paved the way for a life of low-impact leisure. Or so it would appear at first. For those of us who didn't peak during the early stages of our lives, well, where's our inspiration? Who is the hero for the computer nerd and the marching band wedgie target? Well, one doesn't need to look any farther than Dilbert impersonator and fried dough aficionado, Drew Carey. After the death of his father at age 8, Drew battled depression and thoughts of suicide to become one of the highest paid comedians of all time. I mean, sure, he might look like the man who ate Buddy Holly, but Drew Allison Carey took all the slings and the arrows that life could throw at him and built his own outrageous fortune, not just monetarily, but also of peace of mind. And by his example, we learn that our awkwardness and shortcomings help shape us into who we will become. Pain plus time equals laughter. The math doesn't lie. Too bad that the Browns will never win a Super Bowl, not even in Madden 2K11. And with that, I turn the spotlight to the two other people in the Showcase Showdown, Mr. Rick Emerson and Ms. Dawn Taylor. Your thoughts on Drew Carey?
I have to confess to, being a little bit late to the Drew Carey party because I resisted. I think because my first exposure to him was not, I don't think I saw him when he was doing stand-up initially. I think I saw him on the Drew Carey show, and I think that was really the first time he'd sort of, you know, he was on my radar. And I just, you know, the Drew Carey show, sitcoms are real hard for me anyway. It takes a lot for me to really enjoy a 30-minute situation comedy. It's very, very difficult. And I think, you know, and if you add in a laugh track or even a studio audience, which sounds so much like a laugh track, it becomes even more difficult. So I think I resisted. And my friend Brandon actually had one of Carey's books. I think it was Dirty Jokes and Beer.
Mm-hmm. That's his first book.
I think he got me to read that. And I think it sort of brought me around to think that the guy was actually, that he was really funny. And that's when I started to pay attention to him. So I was a little bit late to the party, Drew Carey seems, and I know a lot of comedians, a lot of artists in general are, you know, sort of that they battle, you know, with, you know, self-esteem or with, you know, or with depression or with substance abuse, or they're just, you know, they're troubled individuals in some ways. And a lot of times you don't see that, you know, you find out about it later. A lot of times you see it and it becomes part of their shtick. But then there's a sort of third category where you don't necessarily see it, and they don't necessarily make it into a lot of the grist for their show, but you just sort of sense it. You sense that it is sort of looming.
There's a fracture somewhere.
Yeah, it is just underneath the surface. And Drew Carey always seemed that way to me, that you could just tell that there was something sort of churning inside, even if you didn't always hear it. And that's what made him interesting, is there was a sort of – there was a slightly – desperate's the wrong word for it, but there was a slightly sort of desperate or manic kind of energy working just behind the eyes. And it took me a long time to put my finger on that, but I think that's why he's got the kind of charisma that he does. Don, your thoughts?
I always really enjoyed Carey as a stand-up comic because he's one of those guys. I mean, the truism is that comedy comes from pain, and it comes from anger. And he is one of those comics that seems like such a friendly, jovial person. But there was also this really nice, I always found, like, undercurrent of anger. Not as furious as Lewis Black, but still anger. One of his jokes from his stand-up act that my husband and I actually sort of, you know, riff on all the time, you know, just in a day-to-day life, was when he was talking about how there are always do-gooders who want to, like, remind you that you shouldn't smoke and that you shouldn't eat things that are bad for you. And you'll be standing there minding your own business eating a cheeseburger, and someone will walk up and say, well, you know, that cheeseburger is going to kill you. You say, oh, why, thank you, citizen. I almost experienced a moment of joy. And there is this sort of just furious anger, you know, underlying a joke like that I personally find delightful.
Yeah, with Drew, you can sort of tell that, you know, he's never, you know, been singled out as like, oh, look at that hot guy. You know, which one? The one over there in the glasses and the buzz cut.
Although he was pretty buff when he was in the Marines.
Yes.
And he was a mighty fine-looking specimen, at least for a while.
Well, he had sort of a bell curve.
You've never seen the photographs
thing of
him when he was in the Marines.
He was actually really, really in shape when he was younger. Yeah, when he was in the military. And then he was huge. And then But then recently he's actually gotten all thin again in a sort of strange in a strange way, it almost is like it happened. I think there was speculation that he was not well because it happened really quickly, it seemed like. But apparently he just...
He also had some plastic surgery on his face, too.
He had some work done?
So he looked a little bit, a little shiny, a little leathery there for a little bit.
A little tight for a while?
A little tight for a while.
There was, people were speculating that there was maybe something wrong with him. And he actually just said, you know, who I get the sense that he is the kind of guy who might find out in a few years that maybe this was not all it was positioned as being. But he said that he just woke up and he was tired of being a big guy again. And he just decided to go on a crash diet, and who knows? I think he's talked about not being diagnosed as such, but having a lot of tendencies and characteristics that are similar to those of bipolar disorder. That he does go through manic stages and depressive stages, and he did. Did we mention that he did in fact try to kill himself? I think at one point.
Yeah. After his dad died at age 8, you know, you kind of that really kind of shakes you to your foundations, and you get one of two paths that you can take. You can either let it sort of like simmer and turn into just a ball of rage where, you know, you're just this angry person for the rest of your life, or you find a way to kind of obviously laugh at it, you know, in a sense. So with that, you mature with this loss. So you there's always like this aspect of your mentality that's never really fully developed, and something else kind of grows into it to kind of fill in that gap. But there's always going to be that one missing breaker that would sort of connect the two. So you have to sort of instill in it yourself what could have been in that mentality. So with comedy, that's really what sort of fuels that, is you got to let the laughter kind of overtake the sorrow in that sense. Not to sound too, you know, psychological.
Now, is he, because he's doing the Price is Right thing, is he doing stand-up? And I mean, is he still tour? Or is he a guy that just made his money and figures like, this is the easiest way I can pay the rent now?
I think for the most part, yeah. You don't hear too much. I'm sure he does, you know, people will always want to see him do his stand-up act.
Right.
Considering that's what kind of got his career started. But he's like co-owner of a Seattle soccer team, like Major League Soccer team. So he's really gotten into that aspect. So he's got the money that, you know, he'll not need for the rest of his life. Towards the end of the Drew Carey show, he was making like two-thirds of $1 million per episode.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he was making, you know, a significant amount of money. And, you know, obviously he has a couple of, nice cars and some houses, but he doesn't seem like the kind of person that gets too extravagant. He's not like going to just blow all his cash and like need to do the show for the rest of his life.
Let me ask you this, because you know a lot about comedy. You've been doing it yourself, as a comic for a long time. It almost seems to me, comics seem to have this sort of a cycle. There's a very predictable pattern in some ways, in that comics work, they struggle, they're out on the road, they're doing 300 nights a year, and they're starting at the Chuckle Hutch, and then they're going to the Comedy Store, and they're going to wherever. But then and then somebody says, like, hey, do you want a sitcom? And they go, yes, I do. And they all go to the sitcom or the movie career almost as like it's a lifeboat to get them out of doing comedy. And so is it that they're doing comedy just at... Because when you're 18, nobody's offering you a sitcom. I'm not saying they're doing comedy. I'm not saying they don't really enjoy doing it. But you're doing stand-up because you want to perform, and you don't really have any other options or avenues when you're 18. Stand-up is the one that's available to you because it's just a stage and a mic. So is that what's available to them? And so they take that. And then when something else is available, they take that. And then, you know, the more options you have, you know, maybe you go a different way. Or do you think it's that they just grow to hate it after a while?
Yeah, honestly, because there's no root system where you're at. You're a constant, on the road. Bands need to take time off as well because, you know, there's no real, like, one-set venue. Like, if you're a band, you don't just set up shop at a club and you perform there right every single week. You constantly have to be out on the road and making albums and everything else. But with comedy, you know, you're by yourself. It's so lonely. You know, there's nothing really to sort of cling to. But, you know you're going to have an empty hotel room to go back with. You know, if you do have a family, if you have a wife and the kids, they're someplace, you know, on the other side of the country or sometimes on the other side of the world. And you always feel kind of detached from that, which is ironic because at the same time, you're in a profession where you're in a room full of people and they all feel kind of included in your sense of humor. But at the same time, you don't have that connection with them because right, you're there almost on autopilot after a while. You want to have something where you can kind of, just perform, be funny, but yet at the same time go home at the end of every day and have your family and everything else there as like your root system.
In Steve Martin's book, Born Standing Up, he talked about his, you know, sort of all of the years he toiled away doing, you know, working on his act, and then just boom, like went from zero to famous just very, very quickly. And how incredibly lonely it was, and how tiring, and how the only people he ever really met on the road were fans. So, you know, he'd call down for room service, and a bunch of guys would come up with arrows through their heads. And he's like, it's not that he doesn't appreciate it, but just, you know, fine. And then they'd go away, and then he'd watch TV and sleep and get up the next day and do it all over again. And when he first, when he did The Jerk, he, for the very first time in his career, since, you know, he'd been doing, you know, working with a bunch of people doing like stage stuff at Knott's Berry Farm in his 20s, he actually had colleagues. He had people he could sit down with and have lunch with every day. And he realized, I really want to keep doing this movie thing because I get to have friends.
Right.
I get to be around people, you know, and that was a huge reason, I think, that he burned out on doing stand-up comedy was, you know, it was the combination of, yeah, he was lonely and he was burning out on just doing the same thing over and over and over again. But also, once he did a movie, he realized, oh, there, I could know people.
Well, movies, almost, and that's almost the best of both worlds, because you've got some sort of stability in the sense that, you know, you're working on a movie for 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks. And it also provides you an income, and sometimes a very good income. At the same time, you're not doing the same thing over and over and over again. It is, you know, so it is both. It's the stability and familiarity of the routine, but it's also a constant refreshing, and it's a constant, you know, it's a constant updating of your material in a sense, because you're, you know, even if you stick within the genre of comedy, you're always getting to stretch your muscles and do something in a different script, but at the same time, you're not having to be in a different city every night. I think it also, you mentioned that the only people he ever met were fans. Probably I would add to that that if you're a comedian, you probably meet two kinds of people. You meet fans, you meet other comedians.
Yeah.
And that either...
There's a reason comedians usually end up marrying women who were waitresses in comedy clubs, because that's like the only people they meet.
I was actually going to say that, yeah, you either that goes one of two ways. You either end up loathing other comedians or other entertainers, and so, yeah, that's where you just go find some chick at a Waffle House in Schenectady, and that's because it's like your connection to the real world. Or, you know, you end up being a celebrity who just is incapable of dating, marrying, or spending time with anybody who's not a celebrity, because they're the only ones that understand this bizarre worldview, this strange, like, alternate universe that you sort of live in. And I would imagine that can be a very, it can be a very sort of, you know, that could be a very sort of isolated feeling existence. You know, maybe, you know, people say it's lonely at the top, and I you know, maybe it is, maybe it's not, but it's certainly different at the top. I think we probably, you know, we all know that. So, all right, well, that explains a lot. Drew Carey, if somebody wanted to, you know, if they maybe only know him for The Price is Right, if they've seen his show a few times, they don't really know a lot about his stand-up, where do you start? Where do they?
I would say... I'd say start with his book, because he was a writer before he actually got in with the sitcoms. And, I mean, he went from basically stand-up to writing for sitcoms and then pitching his own show. So I would start with Dirty Jokes and Beer. And really, because when you're talking to an audience, it's very difficult to find an artist that actually will, you know, talk to the crowd as opposed to talking at them. Like, I'm throwing my jokes at you, you're hearing them, they're tickling your funny bone, you're laughing, and I'm getting that response. But to actually, you know, connect with you one-on-one, the best way to do it is to go through their writing, because that really is a very personal, direct one-to-one kind of thing. So I would say start with Dirty Jokes and Beer, and kind of go from there. He didn't put out too many comedy albums, so it was kind of interesting that he went from writing and then the Drew Carey Show, which, I mean, for its own right, was did its best to kind of stay away from the standard kind of stereotypical aspects of a show. Their case in point would be the April Fool's show every year, where it would just be the most bizarre stuff, that very nonsensical, almost like the back cover of Highlights magazine, where, what's wrong with this picture kind of thing. And then after a while, they're like, okay, if you're going to pay that much attention, we're going to have a contest to see who can pick out all the different things that we have going on in the foreground, the background. Sort of do that. So with that, I mean, it really was revolutionary with their with the aspect to it. So yeah, I would say start with Dirty Jokes and Beer to truly get a feeling for Drew Carey and his inner demons.
Also, interestingly, I always thought of all of the Comedy Central roasts that they've done of people, the one of Drew Carey is hands down the funniest. And I think part of it is because he he does come from a stand-up background. So the other stand-ups don't feel like they... First of all, you got... I don't know. It's almost like the gloves were extra off.
Well, yeah, because they knew that he knew the deal.
Right.
Yeah.
And it is just vicious and profane and hilarious.
Well, and especially you're talking about a guy who goes on and on and on at the drop of a hat, who has never made any secret of the fact, for example, that I don't know if he's married or whatever now, but he for a long time talked about how he just picked up hookers constantly. And even when he was famous, he said that he would talk about how he wasn't really able to deal with or relate to normal women, and so he would just go get prostitutes. And it's like, so that is, again, part of that weird sort of fractured personality. But also, when you've got a guy who just says that, like, to People magazine, you know that the roast probably, there's much grist there. Big Jim Willig, you can find him at facebook.com/jim.willig.
J.Willig1.
I'm sorry. J.Willig1, numeral 1.
I'm going to make that a link and just shoot that to you so that way it's on paper, it's right in front of you, it's easy to remember.
Thank you.
No problem.
Okay.
He's got my phone number memorized, Jim.
I'm
a cursory player in the Rick Emerson universe. You kidding me?
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. Just a few. We'll do our fifth clue for the week for the EH Vending Name That Snack contest. Don't forget to join us next week. A couple of things. First of all, Monday, Don Taylor and I are going to be guesting on Fun Employment Radio. That'll be Monday evening. Get that at funemploymentradio.com around 6 p.m. or so. We'll be doing that. Let's see. Also, Monday, Ryan White from The Oregonian, music editor from The Oregonian, is going to be in the studio with us. Tuesday, Mr. Chris Witherspoon is an area filmmaker who's made a new horror movie called Rage, which is getting fantastic reviews. He'll be in the studio with us on Tuesday along with Mr. David Walker. And Wednesday, we'll be talking to Kelly Clark. Thursday, Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. And, of course, Jim Willig back next Friday with another installment of Humor Me. Subject for next Friday yet? Do you know? Have you decided?
Flip Wilson. Come on now.
Look at you.
Big guns. Playa. Big guns.
Stretching the legs.
Wow. All right, then. Joe Squires in the studio with us today from Squires Electric. I do have the number memorized, by the way. It is 503-252-1609. Or their website is SquiresElectric.com.
Proud of you.
I wanted to ask, there's something that I've been saying about you guys, and I want to make sure that I've actually been saying that. I think it's true, but I want to make sure that I've got the story right. Did you tell me that there was a guy who actually had you come out to his house or his whatever and literally fixed like a single outlet or a single socket or something, and then later it was like, come do my entire house or building or something?
Yeah, it was actually a big realtor on the east side. This is, 12, 13 years ago. He had me come hang a light, and then 2 days later had me hang another light, and then a week later he's like, hey, I'm doing a 5,000-square-foot addition on my house.
It's like, you're the man. Come do it.
And, would you like to do that? Yes, I would. And then he started handing my name around. And, yeah, literally hanging a light accounted for a third of my business that year.
What's the most frequent thing that you guys get called out to do? I mean, is it repairing something, or is it installing something, or is it just like an inspection before the city comes through? Or what's the most frequent thing you guys do?
Well, we do a lot of work for property managers. So, I mean, heat, it depends. In the middle of the winter, the first cold snap, it's, heaters stop working.
Right.
Lights, mostly it's lights that stop working, but we do a lot of restoration work for insurance companies, Kennedy Restoration, etc.
How often do you get you get called out because somebody has, usually a guy with a Bob Vila book, has tried to fix it himself, and it's like he put the screwdriver into the wrong thing, and then it was just...
That happens quite a bit.
Really? Does it?
We try and make it as painless and as embarrassing, least embarrassing for the guys.
Is it often the significant other who calls and goes, look, Phil tried to fix something, and I don't know what's wrong, but now the hot water heater it exploded, and there's aphids everywhere.
Apparently we can't fix a furnace with peanut butter. Yeah. Now we know.
A couple months ago, somebody called me on a Saturday, and we had to do an emergency call for them on a Saturday, and they'd accidentally turned their breakers off. And and you feel bad for people like that.
So basically, just
there you go.
And is that's the sort of thing where, again, you go, sir, I can see how this might have happened. It is terribly complicated. It's no, I understand.
It happens to everyone.
No, really, it happened to me at home actually just last week. It's don't you worry about it.
No, we try and troubleshoot that over the phone before we come out. But
is that a thing where you where Donna just says, have you turned it on?
Yeah.
Okay, try that then. Okay, great. I'll wait here.
Donna's getting pretty good at troubleshooting.
Hey, can we ask you a question about Donna? Here's
Donna's our office manager, by the way.
Donna is fantastic, and Donna has been...
She's the matriarch of the entire place.
She, seriously, I get the sense that it's almost like... It's almost like it's going to end up being some Kaiser Soze thing where it's like it turns out that she really is like, she is, the maven of just the entire
She's
outfit.
Actually Joe Squires. This guy is just like an actor hired to pretend to be him.
So where...
that is funny.
How do I put this? Where does Donna come from?
She's West Virginia.
Okay. I say as though that explains everything. She is the greatest combination of just charming and polite and sort of and maternal in a really great way. But then she'll say something just unbelievably unexpected or crude, like out of the blue, like maybe she's had one or so on a Friday. And you kind of go, wow, I didn't expect to hear you say that just now.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that I can't say on air that, you know, she surprised me every once in a while. But we pass. I've had more inspectors ask me, you know, but well, how is... You know, who is Donna? Is she single? You know, you get the middle-aged inspectors and, you know, I'm going to pass you. Just tell Donna I said hi.
Oh,
you know,
nice.
It's just, all yeah, right, she helps me pass inspections. But every once in a while she'll drop. We used to have a, our bank comes and picks up our deposits. And the delivery guy or the pickup guy used to be a black guy. And every time he walked in, I kind of cringed. Donna would be like, so tell me. You know, oh, no.
Can you tell me about Seoul?
It's just, yeah. Does it hurt? I mean, just, no, it's just.
I don't even. Okay, I didn't expect that conversation to go that way.
No, there's an old, what the heck was it? There's an old sitcom where, and I want to say it's like a Exit 52 kind of thing, you know, where, you know, she, you know.
It's all so awkward.
You know.
Here's the only reason.
But I can't look away.
Here's the only reason that I did not immediately figure that was a reference to something else. I won't give the details of this on the air. In mixed companies, they say, but Don and I were in the kitchen at one point. Don and I were prepping for the show a few months ago, and we were figuring something out. We were doing like we're trying to give something away. We had some prize, and we're like, what kind of contest? And Donna was in there microwaving. So there's Don and I sitting at the table. Donna is over, she's microwaving her lunch or, you know, getting coffee or something. And Don and I are throwing ideas back and forth. Well, I don't know. We could do like a name that tune, or I don't know, maybe we should just like I don't know, the, you know, if you want to write an essay about why you should get the prize. And then Donna just without even really just looking back at us, without even just as though it was the most natural thing in the world, she opined that perhaps the best and most entertaining mechanism if we're giving that prize away would be for various male members of the audience to compare the dimensions of their
of their what, right?
Their area.
Of their area,
the business,
like Portland
area, rug,
exactly, the area, the inside of their area,
like living room dimensions.
Yes, exactly, the dimensions of their living room, the height of it specifically.
But we made that as awkward as possible, didn't we, Jim? Nice work.
Found it.
And Don,
fist me, Jim.
And so anyway, SquiresElectric.com is the website, or 503-252-1609. You really are Donna, aren't you? You're going to unzip at some point like old man Carruthers. And, you know, Rick, how are you?
Like Mission Impossible 2. Where?
Let's do this. We'll pay one final visit to the news desk here, and then we'll give our clue for today for Name That Snack for Friday. It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program at the news desk. This is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
So many things I wanted to get to today, and I miss them, but I guess we'll have to do this one. So, an actress from the TV show Facts of Life.
Oh, I forgot about this. Okay.
We should all say our guesses.
Okay, so this is, and we didn't do the snuff watch either.
She's written a memoir, and in which she discusses her quest to become an actor and admits that she's a lesbian.
That one.
See, now, don't reveal it yet, Don, but we'll go around the room. So, Jim, you're saying Mindy
Cohen. You're guessing Tootie.
Natalie.
Cohen. My guess was Tootie, just based on the namesake.
Okay.
You can't have a name like Tootie and not like a little bit of Rudy Tootie Fruity.
I don't even know what that means, but I like it.
Emerson After Dark.
Here's the... okay, so I was thinking that, okay, it's probably Mindy Cohen as Natalie. I wish that it was Kim Fields who was Tootie, but it could also be Nancy McKeon who was Joe.
I am impressed that you know. Seriously?
I'd be disappointed if you didn't know.
But then again, I know this isn't necessarily a romance.
And who even remembers that Molly Ringwald was on the first season?
Or George Clooney, for that matter.
Yeah.
Over our heads.
I know Elton John was married at one point, too, so it's not like that's any roadmap. But I know Nancy McKeon was married, at least she was recently. So... You know, who's to say? I'm going to go this way. I'm going to go Mindy Cohen. I'm going to say Natalie.
Interesting.
Interestingly, you are all wrong.
Oh.
Wait a minute. It's the mom.
It's not. It is not Lisa Welchel.
Mrs. Garrett. Thank you.
Cloris Leachman. Yeah.
For the block.
No. Jerry Jewell, who played
Cousin Jerry.
Wow.
The muscular dystrophy girl?
That's yes.
Stand-up comedy?
That's
yes.
That's out of left field.
But that's not fair, though, I think, because she was like a cursory character.
Come on.
Yeah, but how am I supposed to fantasize about that? That's nothing.
Were you fantasizing about Cousin Jerry already?
No.
I mean,
Natalie?
Not that kids on braces don't need love, I suppose. I, you know, whatever. I mean,
in her new
very delicate love.
In her memoir, I'm walking as straight as I can, transcending disability in Hollywood and beyond.
Wow.
The actress openly discusses her cerebral palsy, her status as the first person with a disability to have a recurring role in a primetime TV series, and admits that she's a lesbian.
Okay, so it wasn't muscular dystrophy, it was cerebral palsy, and she was, that's right, she was a stand-up comic, because she had the weird, slanty way of talking.
Yeah.
And then,
wow.
You know it's true.
Boy, you're going to get some phone calls, Rick.
You know.
Boy, someone's going to get some phone calls.
Like I'm so wrong somehow.
Wow.
I'm not trying to mock. That's how she had impairment.
Is she Catholic, Don? Is there something else Rick could make fun of?
This is a target-rich environment already. I know, so
she apparently did throughout the course of her life. She also had trials including backstabbing agents, tax issues, addiction, an unsuccessful marriage, and a tragic accident.
Well, her and
Randy, now she's happy about talking about her story.
Her and Randy Quaid would get along.
And she if you'd watched Deadwood, you would have seen her on Deadwood.
Really?
Like, right. Yes, she was
doing
really terrific
comedy.
On Deadwood. Yeah.
Okay.
I missed that. I missed
almost,
that entire
she
season.
Played a,
show. I sure didn't watch that.
She
with arm garters.
She played a.
There's just, one more phone. If you weren't getting one before there.
Let's go, folks. who's here from out of town? Super. Mississippi? Is that really?
There's a new sheriff in town. I can't do this.
Freeze!
I can't do the list. I'm sorry.
Well, apparently, yes, she was on Deadwood, and her co-star Ian McShane provides a blurb for the cover of her memoir.
Okay.
Walking
so there you go.
Walking as straight as I can.
That's the thing where they just had the title and they worked backward from there. That's all it is. They just had that sitting around somewhere.
I got it. You're a lesbian.
Yeah. Could you be a lesbian just so we can make the title work?
God damn. All right. Jim, will you do me a huge favor? Will you open the door and see if Greg and Sarah are lurking in the kitchen? Normally, this is where I text Greg and I say, sorry, we're running just a little bit late. No, the coast is clear. Don, let's do our snuff watch.
Okay.
Here is your snuff watch for Friday on the Rick Emerson radio program. We'll do your snuff watch, then we'll get clue number 5 for the Each Vending Name That Snack contest, then we'll call it a day before we've offended most of the Western Hemisphere.
The bumper music for that is.
Well, this reported by the consumer publication, which I'm sure you read, Rick, Gifts and Decorative Accessories.
Do I ever?
Magazine. Milton Levine, founder of the science toy company Uncle Milton and inventor of the ant farm habitat.
Oh, my God. Uncle Milty's ant farm.
Died on January 16th at the age of 97. Levine was married for 65 years to his wife, Morissette, and is survived by children Steve, Ellen, and Harriet Levine.
Did the other employees of Uncle Milty's put him on their, did they lift him up and did they carry him out and bury him by a plastic barn behind the company?
According to Wall Street Journal, Levine's first encounters with ants were when he made mini terrariums of them in mason jars on his uncle's farm. The company, however, is not named for that uncle. Rather, Levine named it that because people also often asked him if he was in the ant business, where was the uncle? So he wrote a book in 1970 called Ant Facts and Fantasies.
That's right up there with straight
okay,
as I can.
Yeah.
Levine was watching ants. Fantasies. He was watching ants during a 4th of July picnic in Studio City in 1956 when he was reminded of collecting ants in jars as a child. This he told the New York Daily News in 2002. He recalled announcing, "We should make an antarium."
An antarium. An antarium is great because it's like some weird steampunk version of our world as we know it now.
He and his brother-in-law, E.J. Kosman, came up with the transparent habitat, a green plastic frame with a whimsical farm scene. That allowed people to watch ants dig tunnels.
It totally had a barn, and I think there was a windmill in there,
too. There was a little windmill. Ants were sent by mail. collectors got a penny apiece to grab red harvester ants from the Mojave Desert. He told the Times, ants work day and night. They look out for the common good and never procrastinate. Humanity can learn a lot from the ant.
So first of all, Antarium sounds like a place that's like a place that a supervillain would like, you know, would sort of like dash to in some 1940 to quick to the Antarium. And it was, you know, and that's and then on the business of the collecting ants for a penny apiece in the Mojave Desert is the worst job I've ever heard of in my life.
Seriously.
Talk about jobs Americans won't do for that wage, right?
It's like
there.
Terrestrial radio and then collecting ants in the Mojave Desert for a penny apiece.
Well, that was in the 50s. What's that wage adjusted?
Yeah,
10 cents.
10 cents.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money for an ant, really.
As well go work for a newspaper. Jesus.
Apparently, the ant habitat toy was an instant hit, although they had to make some changes over the years. The original glue was toxic to some ants, so they had to change that. And then the sand was switched to a whitish volcanic ash to make the ants more visible. Levine sometimes joked that the ant's most amazing feat was putting his three children through college.
I always put the ant thing up there with like the sea monkey on the back of the comic books.
Well, the thing about the sea monkeys,
the ants always died. Well, but always, always,
but,
always.
But the thing is, at least with the ants, you're getting some semblance of your money's worth because they're, you know, ants. The sea monkeys, they're just goddamn brine shrimp.
Yeah.
I mean, from the Salt Lake, I might add, in Salt Lake City. And so
the one thing we all learned from the ant habitat really was how ants bury their dead.
That's, well, and I...
No kidding.
Was it on this version of the show that we had the ant farm or that I talked about my ant farm?
Mm-hmm.
No, it must have been the last stage of the show at CBS. So I bought at Brookstone a couple years ago. They still sell ant farms, but they've really, I mean, it sounds dumb, but I mean, ant farm technology has really come a long way because the thing you can buy now is it's a glass case, and instead of being filled with sand, it is filled with this opaque blue gel, which they tunnel through, but which apparently also is in, like, it has nutrients or something in it, so they eat that as well. And by having an opaque blue gel there, what it allows them to do is at the bottom of the ant farm, there are three embedded lights. And it illuminates from the bottom. So, you know, 24 hours a day, it sort of glows. And you can just see the tunnels. It brings them into stark relief. And it's much more whatever. And I was like, you know, and of course, I'm an idiot. So $39, of course, you know. And I bought it and whatever. And I sent away from my aunts. And they, you know, and sure enough, it's like those bastards got within 2 minutes of being there. They're like, I guess this is where we live now. Dig! You know, and they went right to – it was sort of – you know, it's like when you realize – it's when you realize that, you know, like how unproductive you are in your life. You know, like – you know, it's like if I come in here and it's like I got a different kind of pen. You know, it takes me a while to adjust to that before I could even do the show. And it's like they've just been dropped into an alien environment with a substance that by definition they have never seen in their life that is like nothing else on Earth that they have ever done. But they're like – dig it and eat it. Start you, Charlie, over there. Ted, down to the left. And then they go right to it. And so then, but then, of course, I just had this horrible, it's like John Rogers said about when you buy a dog. It's like, you know, you're buying the saddest day of your life. And so it's like as the ants, you know, got older, I was like, oh, but they're going to die someday. And that day was like, you know, a week later when they just started keeling over. And then it's like, but then it's
diabetes from eating the blue gel.
And then it's sort of creepy and impressive because it's like, you know, it's sort of, you know, when does, you know, remember me through your work that I may be eternal. And so it's like as he would die, his friends would be like, well, okay. And then, you know, Jerry's dead. Here you go. And they toss him back. And then his friends go stick him up top. And then they just, it's like you hear about those guys that were buried inside the Great Wall of China, you know. You know, it's like Han stopped moving. Keep going for the glory of, you know. You
or
know.
The Hoover Dam, for that matter.
And they just put them right inside.
Well, I mean, I'm just glad that the newer ones actually have food because I know the old ones didn't. They didn't have food.
Yeah, they eat the gel, or so they claim.
Yeah, but the old ant farms, like the old school, like the one that I remember, where it's just the ash, you're basically buying like a starvation camp for ants. And you slowly get to wild. Like, yeah, you get to build a little place. Do they keep tunneling, hoping that maybe there's like snacks at the bottom of the case? I don't think so.
Sort of it's an entomological diet.
Really? It's really got it messed up.
It's like when you play The Sims and you just put everybody in an empty swimming pool and don't give them a ladder out and you just watch them slowly starve to death.
I was so sad when the...
Not that I've ever done that.
Playing God.
The saddest moment for me was when there was just a single ant left. Oh, and you know what? And he just kept working, though. You know, he was just like...
what
you
else know, is he going to do? Write a novel?
For the memory of my ancestors, do I continue? And then once they were all dead, I thought, okay, well, you know what? And so then I spent, like an idiot, like about a week and a half catching ants in my front yard.
Nice.
I'm at this point 35 years of age.
Because he needs friends.
Putting them in, And so what did the other answer? They go, well, there's just corpses everywhere. Well, I guess we clean it up. Guys, let's go. And it's like they're so good-natured about the whole thing. It's like if you moved into a house that was filled with bodies, you'd be like, F this. Get me a new house. I want a new house with no corpses. And they're just like, look at this great place. Of course, we'll have to get rid of the death that's everywhere. But all right.
What'd they do with them?
They put him up top with the other guys by Uncle Milty by the barn.
Wow.
They just took him up top and they build a little burial ground. It is sort of fascinating. All right. Well, that guy's dead. So we should end this and do the snack before we just completely.
It's either that or you hear just a truly horrible penis story, but I don't think we have time for that.
No, we don't have. Not that we're not interested.
It's Friday night.
Here's the Jim Carroll Band with your Snuffwatch clothes. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We share the studio with Greg Nibbler and Sarah X. Dillon from Fun Employment Radio. Sometimes they tape in the morning. Sometimes they tape in the afternoon. They tape in the morning. Then the good news, bad news is there's nobody to make us leave, and we'll just talk till like 6 p.m. sometimes. In the afternoon, and I believe they tape this afternoon, we sort of have this sort of understanding that we'll be gone 12 minutes ago. And so we do that with varying degrees of accomplishment and efficacy. So
that's why it's at points you've looked over and have seen me like typing things up while we're doing the show, because I realize we actually are supposed
to
get out of
here to ring and run.
Those two drink a lot. I
noticed that, did you?
I sat on one of their shows once, and I'll never forget it. They did it up on the roof. A bottle of Pendleton. They took the cap off and threw it away, and I knew I was in trouble. And they would just shot after shot. And I was there for 45 minutes. I think I drove a little drunk.
he's just kidding, folks. Is that a?
Well, you know, this is your building. You've seen what goes out in the recycling bins.
What fraternity lives upstairs? You know, you're looking for John Belushi somewhere.
Did they? So it was like a brand new bottle. Did they crack the seal on that? Correct. Was that the Pendleton's whiskey you were talking about that just vanished instantly?
Yeah, that's like, oh, they got a bottle. I came in one morning. I was like, I'd love to get a shot of that Pendleton. I'll go back.
That's
gone.
That was a good show.
That was I think something had gone maybe wrong that day on the show where we were having. It was just one of those things where things were a little off kilter, and Dunn's like, I could really use a belt. And she gets over and just walks over to and she's like, what do you mean it's gone? And she was like turning it upside down as though there were invisible whiskey inside still to come out or something.
Nibbler!
And so I think she ended up drinking some sort of mystery Kahlua came out of the fridge.
Was that around Christmas? I remember that.
Yeah.
It's a horrible band name too.
And then we were realizing what sort of bizarre jobs we have in that her biggest complaint was that she was her drinking during the day at her desk was interrupted briefly because the kind of alcohol she wanted wasn't available and she had to settle for a different kind of free alcohol before getting loaded on the job. She's like, damn it, what do they expect me? Oh, it's like I'm in some sort of internment camp.
Like, what am I, Tom Hanks from the Family Ties here? I got to drink the almond extract?
All right, we got to wrap this up. I will say that as we prepare to end, this is going to be clue number 5, your final clue this week.
So hover over your keyboards.
Name that snack. So the way that I just sent Greg Nibbler a text, you said sorry. So very, very sorry. The way this works is we will give you clue number 5, and once we have given out clue number 5, if you are the first person to correctly identify the snack about which we are talking via snack@rickemerson.com, that is snack@rickemerson.com, you will win a delightful heaping helping of consumables from EH Vending. And we've got these prize bags in the back of the studio. We want to thank listener Harper, who came by, actually. She dropped by the studio. Were you here when she came by?
Uh-uh.
She came by a couple days ago. She actually, Harper, who listens to Legion of News, and then surreptitiously listens to this program and the man isn't around because the man apparently her office does they don't approve, and so she listens to us on the sly. So we want to thank her for listening, and she came by to pick up, and she actually said, I handed to her and she said, she sounded like that what's his name, Pete Puma. She goes, ooh, that's a whole lot of stuff. Whole lot of lumps. Indeed, and those lumps can be yours. If you are the first person to identify the snack, we'll give you the final clue in a second. We want to say that EH Vending can be contacted two different ways. Go to their website, ehvending.com, or you can call Josh, the owner, at 360-816 1853, and they handle all kinds of things. It's not just the regular vending machines with the soda and the candy, although they do that. It's also your coffee service. You go into a place, like you go into Jiffy Lube or someplace, and there's the whole coffee setting there, and you go, well, who handles all this? A place like EH Vending. They can also hook you up at those fridges with the doors, you know, like if you're going to be running a deli, you need a place to put your beverages. They can handle all that. Find something that works for you. So if you're being turned away because, you know, you feel like the vending companies that you're talking to now, you know, they're just they're being intractable in terms of price, talk to EH Vending. They'll find something that makes it work. EHVending.com, or you can call Josh at 360-816-1853. All right, so I will ask the audience, as they used to do on Password, not to reveal your guesses, please.
Those are good-looking blue bags.
There really is. There's a...
I thought they were like green room prizes, and I was going to take one.
Here's the thing about those bags. Those are the listener prizes. See that huge cardboard box right behind it? That cardboard box, which is now almost empty, that arrived, I would say, even though the contents had settled during shipping, it was like two-thirds full when it got here. And we initially thought, well, they sent us all the prizes in this box. We have to part them out in bags. And they kind of like, they're like, no, 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 we'll send you the prize bags. The box of stuff is just for you. So that, you know.
And now it's almost gone.
So far, I'm a fan of EH Vending.
Yeah, it was.
They are delightful people.
It really was. It was like the worst and best thing we ever received in the mail. I mean, it was bad, bad news. Because it was like my entire diet just consisted of.
Were they little 100-calorie packs?
No, sir. Here is today's final clue. The final clue for the week for Name That Snack. The snack comes in five flavors, one of which is barbecue. There you go. Don't shake your head at me, woman. That was funny what I just did. By the way, I should give credit where credit is due. Clues courtesy of Cheryl, our Kanakoa, our chief of staff. So I actually, that's not even my own wit. That's just someone, I'm borrowing someone else's amusement there. We had to bring a curtain down on this. We want to thank our special guest, Joe Squires from Squires Electric. Find out more about them at squireselectric.com or 503-252-1609. If it has to do with wires or wiring in your home or business, they can make your life easier. Call them now. Do it! Moral obligation.
Thanks for the invite, Rick. Always been a fan.
You can come. Well, you know, here's the thing. You got to come by for two things. One, we're going to quiz you a little bit of 80s music, and we're going to have you do a top five. So if you bring a top five musically of your own devising.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And we'll talk. We'll figure that out.
Sounds good.
Jim Willig, you can find him at jim.willig1 in the following Facebook. So it's facebook.com/.
Isn't it J.
Is it J or Jim or James?
It's J. Willig1.
Pound sign.
I just verified it. I sent you a link. To it, but it is facebook.com/JWillig1.
There's an old SNL skit about this investment brokerage firm that, you know, didn't quite jump on the bandwagon for getting websites, and they're, you know, it's all serious, and their website was like clownpoopoo.com. I mean,
you should totally see it. That's available.
I mean,
it'll be gone before we get out of this room.
We
had a discussion at my last Mormon book club, and I'm not sure how the phrase came up, but it was decided that my new name for my blog should be Black Hooker Rodeo. and then everyone was going, no, you really, really need to, like, yeah, actually get that domain.
Like, that's available.
Apparently, it is available. There is no blackhookerrodeo.com. Then I realized in a professional capacity, that might not be the best name for my blog.
Unless you're in a Black Hooker Rodeo.
Right.
Duh.
The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milkpacking District in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Don Taylor, advanced technology magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Agler, chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. After a brief musical interlude, we'll have an encore of today's Legion of News episode, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program. The Rick Emerson Show is made possible by a generous grant from y'all. So thank you for listening. Please do spread the word. And we thank you kindly for that. It is Friday, January 28th, 2011. And that is the frequency, Kenneth. As always, thank you for listening. Be safe. Have a good weekend. See you Monday. Bye now.